up in the Senate Revenue Committee. The order that we're going to go in today, we're going to receive a brief update on the federal tax cut from Liz Beth, and then we'll do Senate Bill 6. And if you're here for House Bill 2379 for the work session, we will try to get that. If we get a quorum here, which is always a challenge, we will try to move that bill at some point this afternoon, 2379.
About 15 minutes.
So Elizabeth will give us a 5 or 10 minute.
All right, I'll start in.
Thank you,
Chairman Deckard and committee members. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. And just for your own information, you have a packet in front of you, which basically goes through the federal tax reform changes in H.R. 2, which was just passed last month. And basically, to begin with, to summarize some of the key things, there was a reduction in the capital gains and dividends federal tax rate. So those rates were lowered. Where now, prior to this final negotiated version, we were talking about dividends being excluded, meaning being removed from the taxable income base. This rate reduction is just going to then affect the federal tax liability, which then is fed through to Oregon through the indirect effects of how much gets subtracted from your federal tax subtraction. So this is not having as large a direct negative impact as we originally had anticipated with the original versions of what we saw on the House and the Senate side. Now, the second major point, which we discussed quite in detail during our previous discussions on the disconnect bill, is there were some accelerations then in tax reductions, and these were from the 2001 Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001. Now, basically, the major components was the increase in the child credit by $400. And this is just, there are all sorts of sunsets in this. And in 2003 and 2004 is the increase in the child credit by $400. But then it is sunsetted. And in 2005, it reverts back to the original schedule, which in 2005 would be $700. It is not under current law or prior to this H.R. 2, the $1,000 was not supposed to go into effect until 2010. So that is a provision that's temporary. Again, it would just this is not a refundable credit. It is just a credit. So we were here. You might have heard or read some stories about how for individuals with income between $10,000 and $25,000, they would fill this full benefit of $400 per child, and that's because they don't have the federal tax liability in order to get that full check. So the next major changes were accelerating the marriage penalty relief, and again, these marriage penalty reliefs were just for 2003 and 2004. And then another change that was made was to accelerate the increase in the taxable income levels of the 10% brackets for 2003 and 2004. And again, those are all going to be reverted back to the current schedule beginning in 2005, which in this case would be, we're going to be moving up with the new brackets going from 6,000 to 7,000 and for single returns and 12,000 to 14,000 for joint returns. Mm-hmm. And then in 2005, it reverts back to the 6,000 and 12,000. And then there's also an acceleration of the reductions in the regular tax rate schedules. And this is permanent. This is the one component of this reform that is permanent. The tax rates will be reduced according to what they were scheduled to be reduced beginning in tax year 2006. So the new tax rates will be 10%, 15%, 25%, 28%, 33%, and 35%. So that is something that will have an effect beyond 2006. So then, and then the final component there is an increase in the alternative minimum tax exemption for 2003 and 4. And again, this will revert back to the original level in 2005.
Elizabeth?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Corcoran.
Can you explain the mechanism that was used in the child credit increase? Can you explain how they were able to slice out working families earning between $10,000 and $26,000?
Chairman Dickert and Senator Corcoran, yeah, that's because between $10,000 and $25,000, basically they don't have enough federal tax liability in order to warrant a $400 credit. Okay, so the amount that they had remaining as a tax bill was less than $400. And this is not a refundable credit, you know, like the earned income credit, and now, like in 2003, our working family credit is refundable. But this, at the federal level, the child credit is not refundable.
What a president.
Okay, so then the third important component of this AHR 2 is the depreciation incentives for businesses. And as we talked about with our disconnect bill, we have still connected with any of these depreciation incentives for businesses. So to begin with, the depreciation has a bonus component. And so originally when we were discussing the depreciation changes, we were talking about the Section 179 expensing that was going from $25,000 up to $100,000. And that was for property that was placed in service in 2003 and 2004 and 2005. But now we have, in addition, and what came out of that negotiations was this bonus depreciation, and that increases now from 30% to 50% of the adjusted basis. And it also extends the period. Under current law, this bonus, the 30% bonus depreciation, would go away after September 10, 2004. This extends it to January 1, 2005. So that's the main thing. And then the final component there is the state fiscal relief fund. That's $20 billion. Basically, half of that is for the states to be used for essential services. It could be used for anything. But the other half is dedicated for Medicaid. And we are basically getting roughly 1% of that fund, which is a total of $216 million, of which the flexible amount is roughly $116 million. And on the backside of your packet there, you do have a list of all the different states and the amount that each state is getting.
So, Elizabeth, reading this correctly, and I'm doing the math kind of quick here, it looks like it's retroactive, so it's back to the start of the year. It's $1 billion this year, $1 billion next year. So it's roughly $2 billion or just over $2 billion in tax relief that is coming to Oregon residents. And just gleaning through this.
Personal
side.
Senator Dickert, that's correct, and that's what you can get from this chart here on the next page there. That chart basically shows you on the sixth column there, that's the total federal tax decrease. Like you were just saying, for all returns, it's $1 billion for 2003 alone. And then the feedback effects, which, again, are what just for those who do not hit or are below that $3,500 maximum, because there's a lot of people, a lot of Oregonians, who pay much more than in federal taxes than $3,500. And so when they get a reduction in their federal tax liability, that doesn't have an effect here in Oregon. So the positive feedback effects are $11.76 million, and that's just for those individuals that are below the cap of $3,500.
And do you know, is it fair to say, I'm trying to do the math, that two-thirds of the relief of the package will go to filers of $100,000 or above? I'm just looking at this. You have it broken down by income. Is that a fair statement?
Senator, boy, yeah. I mean, you can just look at those top two brackets, $100,000 to $200,000, and those with $200,000 and over, you have over $600 million there in those two brackets alone. So the benefit is clearly, most of that is going to those over $100,000.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
As Steve Novick once noted at a Portland City Club, the rich have needs, too.
Chairman Dickert, I just want to point out one last point is that, but as much as we see that the impact from the federal tax liability, the benefits are going to the highest income group, the ones who actually give us some of our feedback effect, 80% of it is between those that have incomes between $20,000 and the $70,000 that's in that table. So that's where most of our feedback is coming from. And so it really doesn't matter how the federal government targets their tax cut. If they target those low income groups, then we get more feedback. But if they're targeting the higher income groups, then that's where we don't get the feedback effects. So that's why we only get $11.8 million for $1 billion tax cut.
Right.
Okay, so that's the main thing with this. personal income tax side, I just want to make sure you remember there is the depreciation component. So with depreciation, I've summarized just the two impacts, which again is the bonus depreciation, which is significantly larger than the 179 expensing increases. So the 179 expensing are only about $9 million a year, but with the bonus depreciation, you can see there halfway down the page for 2003-05, the total depreciation allowance there of reduction is $66.8 million. And then and in 2005-07, though, then that turns positive. And again, the reason why is because when you're dealing with depreciation, you're taking these bonus depreciation or 179 expensing, you're taking more of it up front. So then in the outer years, you have less to depreciate. So that's why then it turns positive in the outer year. So in 2005-07, you have a $19 million gain. In 2007-09, you have a $31.6 million gain. So the net revenue impact, then when you add in, like we were talking about, there's those federal tax liability reductions, which feed back as positive revenue here in Oregon. That then, when you add those in, which in 2003-04, was $17.6 million, and in 2004-05, $10.7 million. That then makes an overall revenue impact for 2003-05 of $38.5 million. And then that's a reduction in 2003-05, and then in 2005-07, it becomes positive again because of these positive feedback effects and that you will be getting from your depreciation changes. And that's a $30.4 million increase in 2005-07 and a $50.4 in 2007-09. Okay? So that's basically the federal tax law changes. And just briefly, you have another page there just on the Multnomah County tax law change. And this really is something that we just have to remember how we're connecting again with federal law changes. And since Multnomah County now has a local income tax, at the federal level, they are allowed to report that the taxes that they pay for any local income taxes, that then gets fed through as a reduction, then as an itemized reduction here in Oregon also. So that becomes then a reduction in income for Oregon state revenue. Here, when we're calculating our own state income taxes, we add back the state income taxes that we actually paid in the prior year, and that is not counted as a deduction. It's different than at the federal level where your state income taxes are allowed as a deduction. But then when you calculate your state income taxes, you add that back. So that's an important point. But this local income tax will still be a deduction for Multnomah, for all residents. And so with this three-year local income tax, it's estimated to have roughly an impact of $135 million per year is the amount that would be generated from this revenue. And I took into consideration that not all Multnomah County residents will be itemizing. So if you don't itemize, you will not be having an effect then on Oregon state income tax revenue. So assuming that 75% of all the taxes that would be assessed in Multnomah County are from itemizers, then we roughly are assuming about $100 million a year would be deducted from Oregon state income taxes due to the Multnomah County income tax that is being assessed. And so beginning in 2003-04, those feedback effects, the tax reduction is $6.6 million. And in 2004-05, it's $7.3 million. In 2005-06, it's $8.1 million. So for a total of $22 million as a reduction there from that local income tax. And then on the final, if you just want to summarize them, both of those events, then basically with the 2003 federal law changes, you have a reduction of $38.54 million. Then you've got the Multnomah County income tax reduction of $13.9 million for a total then of $52.4 million for 2003-05 biennium. And again, this is the revenue, you know, due to these tax law changes. And recognize that, as we talked about, there is that other component in the federal law changes that is the state fiscal relief fund, and that is, you know, a positive that will be coming in as grants.
That balances it, yeah. Thank you. Paul, did you want to add?
Well, just, Mr. Chair, this will be part of the close of session calculation. So we'll take the May 15 forecast that you received a couple weeks ago and reduce it by $52 million to reflect these two changes.
So we're basically at 700. rather than the 650 that we received.
That's correct.
Thank you for the somewhat good news.
That was good to hear about that $4 billion in savings, Mr. Chair, though, on the group there between 10,000 and 26,000. They don't need a earned income credit for their kids. Got to save money somewhere.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 6. Good afternoon, Steve. Do you want to update us on the bill?
Mr. Chair, members, you have Senate Bill 6 before you for the first time. It deals with the provision of benefits to employees of school districts, education service districts, and community college districts. The bill establishes an educators benefit board with 10 members appointed by the governor, each for a term of 4 years. And it requires the board then to provide an adequate benefit plan coverage for all of those eligible employees. The board has to contract for health and dental benefit plans that meet the needs of the eligible employees and districts by July 1, 2004. And then it also allows the board to administer flexible benefit plans and to contract for life insurance, supplemental medical, dental, vision, accidental death, and disability type plans. But it also requires the board to offer a long-term health or long-term care insurance plan. So all of the components of a typical benefit plan would either be required or they would be eligible to provide that. It sets up an Oregon Educators Benefit account in the general fund to pay administrative expenses, and directs that no more than 2% of the employer and employee benefit contributions go into that fund for the administrative expenses. And it would also allow payroll deductions for employee costs to be taken out of paychecks. It requires the districts to participate in the board plans by July 1st, 2004. If they have contracts in effect that go past that date, then they would be exempt until those contracts expire. It also makes exceptions for self-insured districts, districts with independent health insurance trusts, and community college districts. And then it would take effect July 1st, 2003.
Thank you. Mr. Sager, would you like to come up? And committee, by way of introduction, I introduced this bill along with the governor's office. We had a work group, and there's a companion bill in the House that's been introduced. I want to give a great deal of credit to, first of all, Representative Morgan, Representative Tootie Smith, and Representative Max Williams, and Representative Elaine Hobson, who all, I think, played a very meaningful part of the work group that we had that really put together this proposal. There is a bill, like I said, that's in the House that is similar in nature. And the impetus behind the bill really is how do you achieve cost savings? Right now we have a variety, I think it was well over 100 different health plans covering teachers and classified employees. And this is really the notion behind it is how do you pull your resources to save a great deal of money. And I think it's no more complicated than that. As the group spent the better part of, I think, 2 or 3 months really looking into this issue, we found that there is just great discrepancy across the state in terms of cost of health benefits, and we found that there would be great value in pulling the resources and finding one pool to achieve that. Mr. Sager.
Thank you. Chair Deckard, members of the committee, for the record, I'm James Sager, Education Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongowski. In addition to the increasing costs of special education and other services, school districts face two major cost drivers. They are PERS and the runaway increases in premiums for insurance benefits. In our continuing effort to help bring these costs under control, we bring you Senate Bill 6. Our bipartisan efforts on PERS reform had to focus on the reduction of costs to the employers. As we looked to insurance premiums, we focused on controlling costs for both employers and employees while providing a quality program. While this is important for school districts and school employees, there are ultimately two beneficiaries of this action. They are, first, Oregon's taxpayers, who once again will see our commitment to being good stewards of their tax dollars, and that we are emulating a state program that has proven itself to be well-run and cost-efficient. But even more importantly, the over 500,000 children of Oregon will see their classrooms and programs over time continue and hopefully expand. I know Steve has walked you through quickly the bill, and in my written testimony I did the same thing with a few sentences, but let me just highlight a couple differences between this bill and the PEB structure that we had, which we followed very carefully as we crafted this bill. In Section 2, where we set up the structure of the board, as was mentioned, there are 10 members. We have two members of the board who have expertise in health policy and risk management, rather than two members from the legislature, which on the PEB board are non-voting members. This is because clearly with the PEB board, the state is the employer. Here we have over 200 employers out there, and so the structure lends itself better, we believe, to the way we've laid this out. We also, as I mentioned, try to then follow the PEB guidelines where or the structure wherever it seemed appropriate. And towards the end of the bill, sections 17 through 20 really is transitional language to get us from where we are today to having the board up and running, the terms of office and rotation, et cetera. So the other issues inside the structure are, like I said, very similar to the program that we have laid out with PEB. The sections 13 and 14 that set up the 2% administration fund that exists for PEB, I wanted to note that the efficiency of the PEB program is that they have been operating at about 0.6% actual cost. So they've been able to stay well under that 2% appropriations, but it does give us that authority, especially here in the early stages, to get the program up and running. So I guess then the question becomes, you know, why this bill? Well, as I mentioned in my opening comments, our goal is to help bring the cost of insurance benefits under control. Some may say it would be easier to simply put a legislatively mandated cap on the amount of money a district may pay towards these benefits, but this would simply shift future increases to the employees. In a statewide pool, the employees can benefit from the reduced premiums as well as the district. Also, we feel very strongly that the amount paid by a district is a matter for local bargaining as a part of the total cost of compensation packages. Others have questioned and will question our projected savings, so I do want to review those calculations for just a moment. From a study conducted several months ago for the OEA, it was determined that the state could save approximately $65 million per year by pooling. I've attached a copy of that document to my testimony. Based on this information, the now solid record of the PEB program, and the budgetary pressures we face in the state, the governor decided we needed to pursue this savings, dollars that can be put back into our classrooms. I want to thank OSBA for their letter showing their costs recalculated. While Steve Carlson, who is on your list to testify, can go into more detail on the original OEA study, it illustrated that pooling all K-12 employees could save several millions of dollars. The OSBA report came to a similar conclusion, saving potentially $75 million, even if all districts were pooled inside the OSBA trust. So having a pool of 80,000 members will allow OEBB, instead of PEB, to negotiate premiums and administrative fees equal to or better than any currently available to districts. But equally important will be our ability to control the future costs by streamlining plans. This process helps to offset the negative effects of adverse selection and helps spread the risk over a larger pool. By concentrating our pool on a selected group of plans, we will not only be able to help control runaway increases, but also make sure that districts in rural Oregon are able to provide coverage for their employees. And I know many are leery of state-run programs, but I must say that the PEB board, administered by Mylea Christensen, has been a great example of how state programs can be operated. Senate Bill 6 sets OEB up under DAS and will utilize the expertise of Mylea's team. This will allow us to maximize our savings, not to the benefit of one organization or another, but to the benefit of the taxpayers and the students of Oregon. Oregon voters, business leaders, and others have called upon the state to find cost savings and efficiencies. Putting all K-12 employees into a statewide insurance pool will allow us to provide a quality benefit at the best price, as we have done for other state employees. Utilizing the state employees already administering the PEP program will allow us to maximize our efficiencies. Freeing up potentially $65 to $75 million or more every year and controlling future cost increase will help our school districts provide the full school year with reasonable class sizes and programs we want for our children. These are dollars that must stay in the local communities for their local classrooms. This effort is worth our energy and time, and we hope you agree. And I'll be happy to take some questions, Chair.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Did you give any concern? I like this pooling idea. I think that I watched the PEB, BUB pooling. I mean, the SEB and BUB pooling that led to PEB. And, you know, it makes sense that there's economy of scales. Why, and I understand that PEB was not interested in OEBB being just a component of PEB, so we have even larger pooling. Seems to me, by the way, that given the difficulty we're having getting any kind of legislation on pooling in terms of purchasing pharmaceuticals and other kinds of cost containment methods, that that pooling would be the way to go. But I guess my question, Jim, is did you guys give consideration to local governments and special districts to look at them being involved in some sort of pooling as well? It would seem to me that they would have the same difficulties as you know, small school districts do, and just curious about that.
Chair Deckard, Senator Corcoran, no, we did not. Not in the conversations that I was a part of. We were really focusing on looking at ways to save money inside the school system structure.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Senator Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Number of public employees covered under PEB, how many?
But I think it's 60,000 or so that's in the pool. I'm not sure.
And then how many teachers and school employees would be covered under this?
This pool would be – I'm sorry, Chair Deckard and Senator Starr. This pool would be in around the 80,000 number if everyone was a part of the pool.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
How many are currently covered in the OSBA trust?
Chair Deckard, Senator Starr, as I understand it, there about 40% of the K-12 employees are in the OSBA program currently with various components of that, and then the rest are parts of either the OEA Choice Trust, OSEA Trust, or other programs that are out there.
Thank you.
Senator Ringo? Thank you. If you could stick around, we might come back to you momentarily.
Thank you.
Let's bring up, well, let's do OSBA. You ready? So whoever you want to bring with you, Chris.
Yes, that's right.
No. Thank you. We have quite a lineup here waiting for your testimony.
Chairman Decker, members of the committee, my name is Chris Dudley. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon School Boards Association, 1201 Court Street, Northeast, Salem, Oregon. And with me is
Mike Gray, actuary with Mercer Human Resources Consulting, consultant to OSBA.
I have some printed testimony for you that's sort of an outline talking point.
I'm no longer actuary tolerant after PERS, Mr. Chair.
This guy doesn't do that kind of he didn't do that kind of work.
Does he have a personality?
Yes.
None of the ones did in the PERS discussion.
He was a native Washingtonian and a Portland State guy.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Much better. We're here before you today to stress our opposition to Senate Bill 6 for a number of reasons. One has already been talked to about, Mr. Sager. The cost savings that are being purported for this bill are grossly overstated. The $65 million saving figure mentioned by some proponents is really a misrepresentation of what OSBA's trust programs are in the current delivery system. If you factor in, given the table we saw that was used to depict 85,000 employees in a more efficient potential statewide pool, saving $65 million a year, if you actually apply our known data about our chunk of the business and our costs, $42 million of that's already been saved because people are buying their insurance in a lot of districts through OSBA's insurance facility. If you want to take a look at how we got there, I've attached a couple of sheets of paper for you. Basically, what happened is in the original look at this whole arena, they assumed that OSBA, OEA, and others had the same claims costs, the same administrative costs, and applied that to a pool of about 54,000 individuals. But if you look at our OSBA correction of Jim Sager's data on this page, like this, you'll see that if you correct it for right below that, what OSBA's actual per person per month claim and administrative cost is, it's 580. And we have in our trust currently 33,804 employees, and that results in $42 million of that saving already occurring per year.
So, Chris, on that, would you, in our one of the meetings that we were all at, you agreed there were some savings. You just weren't. You contended that they might not be as great as. But I think at that point, and the actuary was there. I forgot your name, but you did.
Michael Gray.
Mr. Gray.
You can never remember their names.
So, would you agree there are savings, but you would definitely. Contend that they're not as great as what
I'm saying that, Mr. Chairman, at the day's end, we have a better administrative rate and a more efficient program than PEB. That if you recreated a PEB, they would not get that. You cannot beat our deal, even if you create this thing.
Huh.
Okay? And there's a couple of reasons. One is we're a preferred chunk of business. We've been with them since for over 30 years. We've never asked them to underprice their product. We've pushed them very hard on what they do, and we've pushed down their administrative costs. So the myriad of plans we have, we still have a lower administrative cost than PEB has with its single plan. Now,
why are your premiums higher then?
Our premiums are lower.
So I mean, I know that there was great variance, but
our premiums are lower. We have 8 different programs, okay? But if you go to the predominant program, and this is what's happened over a period of time, we grew up in a competitive market, not a monopoly market. Mm-hmm. And so our trust dealt with 236 employers, not a state. And we were in competition with the OEA Choice Trust, the OSCA Choice Trust, the private carriers, et cetera. So the purpose of this thing when it started was to provide the best possible coverages at the lowest possible price for school districts, mostly the small school district market, because they're the ones that were getting hammered. Mm-hmm. What's happened is over the last 10 years, we've become so efficient and so effective that the larger districts are moving into our plans. We did not expect that, but it's a challenge because they're a different kind of a market. But in fact, if you look at the bill that creates this PEB type board, we will not be able to write that if you allow some of the things that are allowed in that law. And I think Jim Sager pointed it out. The purpose of this is so that employees don't have to share costs. He said it. And that is part of what's going on here. They've got a provision in there that allows your collective bargaining agreement to define my underwriting agreement with the health care company. You cannot do that. And this is one of the reasons we've been effective and provide the kind of service we do at the price we do is if a school district's trying to get around our underwriting agreement, we call them and say, we will no longer cover you unless you fix that. We do not let the bargaining table dictate to us adverse selection in our plans. Okay? Bad ideas. Okay? And it's so easy to get sucked into that at the bargaining table to get a settlement. And I think this is just, this bill is rampant with that kind of problem. And my guess is you will not find an underwriter that wants to deal with this that will give you the same kind of administrative costs that we have, because we aren't that kind of hassle.
So go ahead, Chris.
What happens now is we have a very stable, good plan that districts may take advantage of if they want to. And it doesn't have a state screen on it. It doesn't have this newly created bureaucracy to decide whether it's okay or not, whether they buy it from us. Then districts can self-insure if that's a good deal. If it goes bad, they can come back to us. They can do some kind of a direct contracting with a provider in their community. If they don't want, and we're not boutique, we're pooled, we're truly pooled. We won't just change the benefit structure for somebody, and that's one of the reasons why it's at the overhead cost it is. It's not a little boutique thing. But if you want to have a boutique plan like Grants Pass just bought, because they want to define this, they're going to pay a price for that. But that's what they want to do, and they'll probably not be able to get it as cost effectively as if we're in a huge pool. But that's just the nature of that market. But to say that by creating this statewide pool that you're going to save taxpayers in the state a lot of money is just not true.
Mr. Chair.
One of the reasons, pardon?
Mr. Chair.
We should let Mr. Dudley finish.
But he's correct. I never heard an answer to your first question, which was, if it's not $65 million, is it still $23 million in savings, maybe?
If they all came to us.
Okay.
But not by creating this new structure.
Okay.
Because I don't think you can get the same deal. I'm just telling you, I don't think you can. Now, one of the things we thought we might do, and we talked to some legislators about, why don't you just cap it at, which Mr. Sager talked about, why don't you cap it at the dollar amount that the state now pays for PEP coverage and save money? And so in my sleepless night last night, I went to our database, which is in our thing we call SPOT, and I looked at all the school districts that we have in our database, which is 162 of them that reported for last year. And so I just went down with a red pen and a green pen and a pink pen and a yellow pen and said, okay, if you cap this at 641, which is what the state, about approximate state PEB contribution rate is, how many districts in this state out of that 162 would have a reduction in their cost? And it's 35. 35 of 162. All of the rest of the districts, community colleges, ESDs, and school districts, already have in their collective bargaining agreement caps that beat the dollar amount the state's now paying. And so I was wrong. You can't really save money by doing that, because what would happen is if you decided that the cap would be 641 or whatever you're paying at the state level, all the bargaining pressure would be to go back up to that level.
But that would be, that's locally bargained.
Absolutely. But what I'm saying is this talk about saving money to taxpayers and saving money to the state, in most cases, school districts have already bargained caps on the draw on the tax-supported part of the budget that is more, it is lower per employee than what the state's now paying through PEP. So if you're really talking about cost saving,
Yeah. We're
there. Now, if you want to talk about holding down cost of insurance coverages into the future, then none of the cost drivers are dealt with this bill.
Chris, no. I have to disagree with you on that one, because whatever the figure, say it's 600 at the current PEB rate,
right,
and say you've got, you just have a myriad. You have anywhere from 400 to 900. In some ways, I think your argument chases its tail there, because you can make the argument that by agreeing to 900 in one district, by one district agreeing to a 900 figure, then therefore you would never get a savings, because you assume that they've agreed to 900 with no out-of-pocket for that teacher or classified employee or community college teacher. And so you can make, the same argument you're making by saying a district that agreed to 900, that they have basically bargained away any savings right there.
Well, it's bargaining, and there were trade-offs for that. They might have done something else.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is that school districts have not, it's not like school districts haven't had this issue on their radar screen and are trying to deal with the taxpayer problem and funding health care. What I'm saying is, in a lot of cases, districts have been very responsible in trying to set up cost-sharing arrangements with their employees. And as we've run through the HMO savings, and they're not there anymore, and we're looking at new ways to talk about how you hold down cost of insurance, consumer-driven decision-making is the next thing on the horizon. That means the employee is going to share in some of those costs. and they're going to have to. And I submit to you that experimentation, either locally with a school district or through a trust like ours, is going to be more rapid and more effective than running it through a screen of a state-level agency that has 10 people on it and has to do all kinds of stuff. PEB costs now are about $2 million a year, okay, for that piece of that business. My guess is if you create this, you're going to create another $2 million a year state agency that creates a screen on the market that school districts can access.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
And I don't think that's, in terms of where we're going to have to go in health care and the kinds of changes we have to make, I don't think that's a very good idea.
Senator Corcoran.
So you cover 33,000, I think you said, something,
yes.
And PEB covers?
I think they're 47, I think.
Okay.
They're a little large. They're about 10,000, 12,000 large.
And it's interesting that you used the figure 2 million. So that's what it costs PEB.
About, I think it's 1.9 this year. It's going to be 2 million. It's 0.6. Is it, what did
that's our overhead.
0.6% of total premium. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you guys, in your report for 2001-2002, OSBA reports as a revenue over $2 million from the insurance trust management fee. So is there an additional cost? That must be over what you're charging in terms of administrative fee then, right?
No. The association as sponsor gets a royalty, and that totals from two different trusts, the Property Casualty Trust and the Insurance Trust. And currently we get 1.025% of premium as a royalty for being the sponsor of those plans and bringing them to school districts. The trust committee met Friday, and because of how rapidly it's growing, we asked Mercer, and we did this over the last year, asked Mercer to look at their book of business, about 3,000 clients, what is a reasonable amount for when they get to be our size. And the trust committee changed that to 0.8% of covered payroll as of the contract year that starts October 1st. So we'll still be getting a royalty, but it'll be about 40% less than it has been. And that, by the way, in the 2002 survey of state associations like ours, of the 46 associations that responded, 26 of those associations have some kind of an insurance facility, and five of those states are as reliant on that source as OSBA is. This has been a concern of my board about the entrepreneurial activity revenue push, which has really shielded our membership from having to deal with dues increases since 1995, and quite frankly, service cost increases. But all of that money, Mr. Chairman, all that money that comes from those royalties subsidizes programs to school districts, including collective bargaining, representation, the policy service we do, the board development and training. Last year, because of school district budget problems, we actually waived the registration fee to our conference board members because we knew it was a political problem for them in the district to budget that. But there wasn't a time when they needed this training more than right now. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way we use that money.
So five other states have a similar, I guess, type relationship.
Similar percentage of the budget.
Like
that comes
OSBA
from
does yeah. with the school districts. And then 45 others have just a myriad of other.
26 of the states have some insurance facility, some program. In terms of the percentage of their budget, in terms of the money generated from those as a percentage of their budget, there are five states very similar to OSBA. Texas is one of them. But that's huge. Texas School Board Association is bigger than our State Department of Education. I mean, they're big. They act big. They are big. We are a high-service state association. So if you compare a state association of our population and the kind of programs we have, we're very high. We're like a Michigan or a Kansas or a Ohio or an Iowa.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, it occurs to me, when you say that you're in competition with OEA and OSEA trusts, does that mean that they provide health insurance for administrators as well as the workers? Okay.
They can.
And does PEB or OEA or OSEA Trust, do any of them get a royalty?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know their deal.
Okay.
Pat does.
But, and I should point out,
Pat
by the way,
Pat does.
Mr. Chair, that it is, in fact, two-thirds of their, I think it's two-thirds, of their operating revenue.
That's 50%.
50% of the operating revenue comes from that royalty.
I've got $2,118,000 from the insurance trust management fee and $3,142,000 in total expenditures.
Yes, but total revenues, it's 50%.
50%.
Yeah, it's more than
50%. I just want to clarify that. 50% of your operating revenues are from the royalties.
From the insurance, this insurance trust, from property casualty insurance trusts, from some of the financial things we do, like helping districts put together their UAL bond levies.
Mr. Chair?
But this is by far, the medical is by far the largest because it's the largest dollar per turnover.
Senator Ringo.
So excluding those other things for a moment, how much just from this revenue stream is a percentage of your trust?
About 50%.
Okay. I mean, you said 50%, and then you said, but that also includes some of these other
things. Well, the others aren't nearly as large.
Okay. So even excluding those other things, we're talking 50%.
Yeah, about 50%.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll get the exact figures for you. I don't have them right in front of me.
Probably close enough.
Yeah.
I just want to respond to Senator Decker. You earlier said that we showed that PEB was less expensive than OSBA in the earlier hearing that we had. And what was stated at that meeting was that the PEB rate, composite rate, if we rolled all the employees together per month, was $607. And the OSBA rate was $581. The difference where it gets more confusing is that they made an adjustment. Aon Consulting made an adjustment to the 581 to put it on a benefit comparable basis to PEB. And they increased the 581 up to above 607. So according to Aon, they stated that PEB was a better deal than OSBA. We disagreed with that based on calculations that we had performed.
Who was Aon representing?
PEB. They're the consultant to PEB. So they did an actual calculation that we disagreed with. The other part of what I wanted to correct in terms of data is that in Mr. Sager's testimony, he said that OSBA agreed that there was savings via pool. What we did in the spreadsheet wasn't to agree or disagree with the non-OSBA numbers. We only wanted to take the OSBA numbers out of the column where it was concluded and just represent it based on its own actual premium cost. We understand that there's a study being conducted by the Department of Education right now which would be more precise than the data I believe that is represented here. I don't know this OEA study that was performed. I don't know the basis of what this study is, but I understand that it was discussed at the same hearing that you were referring to, that they would go through district by district and find out not only the benefit plan and the amount that was being paid, but exactly what part of that amount was being paid by the district versus the employees, which would be relevant in terms of savings, in terms of if you move the caps down or if you move the premiums down, what part of that would be a savings to the school districts versus what part of that would be savings to the employees of that school district?
For instance, Mr. Chair, in the item we were lumped in with was the OEA choice and others. We don't know what those two numbers are. We just know what ours are.
Mm-hmm.
And so the $42 million that's already been saved is only on us. We don't know how far off this is on the others.
To have that.
Because it's so far off on us, we don't have any confidence in this data. Now, one of the things that's happening is, as you know, they're doing a survey of every school district in the state to get those numbers. What we're trying to tell you today is don't have a deer in the headlight look about we have to save costs in health care, so we've got to do this thing until you know what the information is. And we're here to tell you that, number one, we have a more effective program than you'll get out of the structure you're trying to create here. The second thing is there's some stuff in this just patently bad in terms of good administration of a program like that. And I'll share each one of those with you if you like eventually. Depends on where this goes. But one of the things it shows me is that it intentionally or unintentionally, it puts the union in the driver's seat in terms of the underwriting provisions. because they can, by their collective bargaining agreement, tell you what your underwriting agreement is with the insurance company. You can't do things effectively that way because people make all kinds of little decisions out here and they don't understand the impact of those in terms of a coverage. They just don't know.
Actually, I have to take an issue with that, Chris. The PEB, I mean, you can say that about local government bargaining, but PEB doesn't do that. PEB is generic. I mean, the only differences in PEB are what the different geographic areas allow in terms of coverage. You know, you got Kaiser up in the north part of the valley, you got Blue Cross Blue Shield in the rest of the valley. They don't, you know, the AFS doesn't get a different plan than Children's Services Division.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Corcoran, no. What I'm saying is that if Regent says, we'll give you this rate for these coverages if you include these people in your unit but not others, and then you allow a collective bargaining unit to define agreement, define who you're going to let in the system.
We can't, but the collective bargaining...
You've then violated the underwriting agreement. I'm saying the way this is written, I believe that can happen under this bill.
Okay.
That's not
happening with PEB right now.
Right. And it shouldn't with this.
So, Chris, would you say, and I just think of the example that you used, that right now under the PEB arrangement that we have, that state employees are in the driver's position because of the way we've structured that arrangement and they're able to drive PEB?
No, I think what happened is that PEB was such a bad act until about 4 years ago that they had to clean themselves up and that they couldn't get an underwriter unless they agreed to do some things.
And you
they
think
burned, they chased premiums and they took the lowball bids, then they left the insurance company holding millions of dollars of debt and walked off and found another underwriter. And you can only do that when you're narrowing, you can only do that so many times.
Mm-hmm.
And so what really happened to them, I think, is they had to clean their act up or they couldn't have got anybody to bid.
And that's
been good for the state.
I don't buy that, Mr. Chair. I watched the negotiations between that three-year contract that they got such a good deal that put Sacred Wallet out of the insurance business was, an open-eyed transaction, you know.
Right.
I don't think they were getting any better bids from Blue Cross Blue Shield. I mean, you guys have a good deal with them. You obviously have a real sweetheart deal with them if you get a 1% royalty over the top in the administration to be able to run the organization. But I don't think, you know, I'd like to look at how PEB's done and let them defend themselves about what they did as they organized and put that together. I don't think it was mismanagement at all. I think they were just out shopping a good deal.
I think they were, too. I think that's exactly what they were doing. They weren't thinking about the long term and how you maintain relationships. And that's part of the problem today. We don't have as many underwriters as we used to have.
And so that's your fear, I guess.
And you can't do that anymore.
And is it fair, Chris, to say your fear would be that we would go back to where we were 5 years ago with this new PEB ad, seeing the benefits of it, but your fear would be is that we would regress to where we might have been 5 or 6 years ago and have some sort of relationship with the new OEBB that was similar to, I guess, mistakes that you described 5 or 6 years ago?
My concern is that if you create this screen on who can do business with school districts, we might not get the nod.
Okay.
That's my concern.
Yeah, I realize that.
And so I don't want to do that. And I don't think you have to do that in the current environment because I think districts have a number of options right now. I don't think the savings is there that's being talked about. And I'll have to correct part of my testimony because I said that we were 58% of the school employees. Our 33,804 is 58% of the number of employees the State Department shows as school district employees, but what I left out was community college, and I don't know where that, I don't know, I've got to talk to them about what that number really is. But I don't know how you get to 87,000. Is that what it is?
85,000.
We don't know where that number comes from.
85.
Which would change the amount of savings if there weren't that many.
Uh-huh. I agree. Senator Starr.
Thanks. Chris, how many school districts currently have caps in place? And how many of those?
I have the data they're still collecting at the other study that's being done right now. But we do a study every year called a salary and benefits survey report, and 162 districts responded to that for the 2002-2003 year. And 88% of those districts had a cap.
Okay, and do you have any idea how many, Mr. Chair, how many of those with caps are members of your trust, and how many are not?
Most of them.
Do we know how? Because it seems to me that the caps are the place to find savings in this discussion, really. Yeah. Districts that already have caps, how are they going to, if we pass this bill, how are we going to save money as it relates to those districts? Seems to me that
Mr. Chair, Senator Stark, the cap does a couple of things. One of the things it does is it protects the integrity of the district's budget from increases in the taxpayers, how much of it they have to pay. The other thing it does, it shifts some of that burden of that cost onto the employee. Okay? And when you do that, you change the dynamic of the decision making. For instance, if I tell my kid I'm going to buy him a car, he'll go out and look for a Lexus. If I tell him I'm going to buy him a car that costs what a Pinto does, he's going to go look at a Pinto or something slightly above that. And so in terms of the long-term cost drivers in the system, I believe, and a number of people believe, that you have to create a system where, through caps and other mechanisms, the employees share more in not only the cost but the decisions, and it's an informed consumer. Now, I'm on the board of the Oregon Coalition of Healthcare Purchasers, which is large healthcare purchasers in the state, treasurer of that organization, and we spent quite a bit of time talking to our underwriters, because underwriters believe that the providers a lot of times believe that you're only buying on price, and so their idea is to get you the lowest price. But in fact, to be more efficacious, you may not want to buy on the lowest price. And we're trying to get our providers to understand that there are some reasons why you want to put some of this stuff in. It costs a little bit of more money now, because over the long term, it may be way more cost effective in the future in terms of chronic care, chronic disease control, et cetera, and those kinds of things. And so one of the things that you have to do, I think, if you look at this into the future, is you have to allow the marketplace for school districts to make their purchases in an arena that allows them experimentation, an arena that allows them to go to a safe place if that's their character and that's what they want to do, but also maybe allow some of them to stick their neck out a little bit with the agreement of their employees and their union to try some stuff that's going to be effective long-term control on costs. Now, I think I told a couple of you, on my tombstone, I'm going to put change is good, you go first. We're kind of in that deal where you know that we have to change and we have to do something to be more effective. But it's scary to do that. And I think an institution like a PEB-type board would have a tougher time making those kinds of incremental changes and experiments than a marketplace, which is a free marketplace and competition. As long as there's a piece of that free market competition arena that has a really effective program, which is ours.
Mr. Chair.
Let's Senator Starr.
Just to follow up, in that free market environment, it seems to me the way to control the cost to the taxpayer is this idea of capping. If the legislature really wants to get a control on the cost and not mess with the free market, why wouldn't we require school districts to have the same cap that the PEB board allows today?
We've thought about that, and that's probably the most effective way to say there's integrity to the budget number. But it may drive the wrong kind of decision in the district, district by district level. I looked last night in my sleepless night thinking about what I was going to do today. I looked at the spot survey of those 162 districts, and only 35 of them have caps that are higher than PEB's premium cost now. So the problem would be, if you actually set it at PEB, you might drive bargaining. You might drive costs up, because that would then become the standard that the unions would expect. The states recognize this as the lid. This should be our lid. And in fact, we've already got caps in most districts that are in that survey lower than that right now. And so I'm kind of torn. I think the most effective way to do it without creating this PEB board would just say, yeah, as a policy, as a state of Oregon, we only think you as an employer should pay from our 80% of money you're getting from us more than X dollar amount. The problem is if you gear it at the PEB premium right now, actually you'd have to gear it at, I think, something like the predominant group, because I think they have different deals with different contracts. that might be a cost escalator for school districts.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on the same lines, the, then instead of using the PEB number, just do an average maybe of what's already out there that the school districts already have.
You could approach this by saying there's a statutory cap on what districts can contribute for, towards health insurance.
And that would provide a incentive and provide protection for the taxpayer, get to the cost drivers, and still allow the free market to work and not have a new state bureaucracy.
It would do that. It would change some relationships.
Just one question I have, because that state bureaucracy, and you listed it in your 4 points, as point number four, is concern about a new state bureaucracy. How many employees does PEP have for the 60,000?
I believe they have 14 today and 17 next biennium.
My understanding was 7 administer, 60,000, a pool of 60,000. But I'll grant 14. How many?
I think it's 17.
17. How many do you would you estimate are out there today? So we've got 17 doing 60,000 in PAP. How many would you say are out there today administering the well over 100 plans that we have in school districts across the state? How big is that bureaucracy? You would just guess.
Well, for 204 of those districts, with 58% of the school employees, that's not quite right because I have the community colleges. For half the school employees, zero. We pay regents to do that.
Mm-hmm. I know.
But for the trust itself, in terms of all those programs, we have a consultant in Mercer, and then we have three people on my staff that, as a part of their job, help. I'm the administrator of the trust, and then we have my executive assistant who helps run the meetings, and then we have the OASBO, the Oregon School Business Officials exec, in on those meetings, so he understands what's happening, and he can translate that to business managers. But we don't have a marketing piece, same as PEB. I think PEB uses regents. There is no similar structure, if you will, that I know of in the school sector.
Mm-hmm. I just...
It's another layer that just isn't
quick calculation of just people I had talked to within school districts, within the myriad of plans out there within OSBA and your portion of it, and just if the concern is bureaucracy and FTE, and the concern is having too many FTE, I was able to calculate 30 to 40 of just direct conversations that I had had, and that's not certainly not scientific, and that's certainly not encompassing all the state of Oregon.
To do what?
That are administering, that are involved in some way or another in the different implementation of health plans throughout the state. And so I thought it was a fair argument of terms of bureaucracy, but I saw this as actually a counter argument that you'd probably get a savings, if that was your goal, a savings in FTE, because PEB has been able to administer an incredibly large number of people relatively lean fashion.
There is no comparable bureaucracy.
I would grant that. I think the point is that there's many bureaucracies throughout the state that are helping to administer. And I just counted on my hand the conversations that I was having within that group of folks that were administering different parts of the plan.
I don't know who you're talking about. So.
Senator Corbin.
Well, I'm just sitting here thinking what a fantasy land it would be to bargain in Mr. Dudley's world that somehow a PEB cap would have workers demanding an increase in health insurance benefits when conversely actually what you do with the cap is it's just a cost shift. You're shifting it over to the workers to make up the difference. And then in terms of that being a rationale, workers owning that more, that they would demand plan adjustments on that basis to save money, your own organization, you know, 2 years ago went from 8 plans to 3 plans. You talked about the benefit of generic plans, so I'm a little confused with the, with how this world of bargaining is working on this. But I don't really have a question. I just want to make that comment. It seems otherworldly to me.
The employees are involved in those decisions now. It's not like they're not. We looked at 127 of the largest school district contracts that we have on file. Ron Wilson, our Director of Human Resource Development, did that. And we can identify in 92% of those cases there's some kind of either labor management committee that does it, or it's done as part of the regular bargaining process. And so those decisions are now being made district by district, depending on what's out there on the market. And that is, I would guess that will be a different environment than if you had this new structure. However, the new structure does allow multiple plan offerings by type of coverage. I'm not exactly sure what it means, but I think they would have the opportunity to have a number of plans. I will be interested to see whether there's 100 plans out there. That surprises me when we get the data back from, because there aren't that many carriers, and we got a big piece of this.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Skipping a little bit in your testimony, since we're not really going down it directly. You know, at the end of your point three, you the last sentence there is, if cost control is a major issue, why does this bill exempt an independent health insurance trust program in Portland,
right,
a prime example of costs running out of control? And I'm just wondering if you could explain whether, I mean, is that OSBA's position, Portland school costs are out of control?
I think in the area of their health care benefits, yes.
Okay, and why is that?
Well, it's being administered by a union trust, a union management trust, that just has not been able to say no to kind of uneconomic offerings. They have very rich packages. We have two of those units that have come to us this year. And under our underwriting agreement, and what we will do, we know there's a couple instances where they were doing stuff we just won't do, because it's adverse selection and it's going to throw your costs up. They have not been able to get a hold of that.
And
that board would have gotten caps if they'd stayed out of that settlement. They would have gotten their caps.
The Portland School Board would have gotten caps.
Yes,
I see.
But the mayor came in and kind of settled it and said, "Give that right now."
And so it's your position that the union beat up the Portland School Board on that health insurance issue?
That and some other management issues, yes. All clearly right. They did, yes.
Patty, I'll agree with you.
I think she'll agree with me.
Well, your point is, okay, so we're exempting Portland. But it seems to me that if that's true, that if the union beat up the board on health care costs, that's what this bill is intended to address. And yes, we're exempting Portland. There may be practical reasons or maybe political reasons, but it doesn't address the purpose of the bill to try to put this on a statewide basis rather than a district-by-district basis.
Yes. Well, a state's different places. Beaverton School District has their own deal, direct right with Regents, that has a retro rating provision like we do, that if they are right, they get money back. If they're wrong, they have an amount to pay back.
Just follow up, Mr. Chair.
That's a regional issue where they may do better than you can do under a PEB board or under OSBA, and I don't think they can continue that after next renewal.
But if Senate Bill 6 had been in place a year ago, the recent example of the health care costs for Portland School District, that wouldn't have happened. Correct?
It would have happened because they're exempt.
Yes, but if the bill had been in place a year ago and there was no Portland exemption, the problem that you're complaining of would not have happened.
I'm not complaining of the problem the way you think I am, I don't think. I think the problem I've got is I think this bill is in front of us because of a few bad examples, when in fact most districts have already got this handled well.
Mr. Chair,
your testimony calls Portland a prime example of costs running out of control.
Yes.
I guess is what I'm trying to point out is that this example that you're using, whether it's true or not true, you're accusing the Portland district of having costs out of control. That wouldn't have happened if we had had the health care costs under PEB, say, a year ago. That wouldn't have happened.
If Portland were buying it from PEB?
Yeah.
No, wouldn't it? It would have been part of a bigger pool.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Yes. That's your question? Yeah, the answer is yes. I didn't understand what you were asking.
Thank you.
And, committee, I think there will be amendments that deal with, or that we will consider dealing with, some sort of date certain that self-insurers, which Portland is one of, would be included in the poll. So that would be something we'll consider. Thank you.
You bet.
You've been very patient, and I hope we haven't caused you too many sleepless nights.
Not bad.
I want to find out how out of control Portland is. Let's bring them up here.
They're in the office.
Don't leave, Patty.
They're leaving.
Don't even think, Patty.
Let's do Church Bozak, Steve Carlson, and your consultant.
Not another actuary.
Oh. Dueling actuaries. It's going to be the story of this session.
It wouldn't be your session.
Yeah, no kidding.
Ryan Waller, I do not have a cell phone on me. I want to report.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tricia Bozak, representing the Oregon Education Association. We represent 44,000 K through 12 classified and certified employees and faculty and staff in the community colleges. We are here today in support of Senate Bill 6. OEA's decision to support this bill didn't come automatically or easily. It is a major departure in how our members are accustomed to doing business when it comes to health insurance. Currently, they negotiate elements and costs of health insurance benefit plans district by district throughout the state. But in recent years, we've seen a number of things happen: double-digit premium increases, more employer dollar caps, increased out-of-pocket payments by employees, elimination of some health insurance benefits to help contain costs, concession in salary to maintain insurance, concession insurance to maintain salary. I think you get the picture. I think some of these are pintos that Mr. Dudley referred to earlier. These are the real-life experiences of OEA members throughout the state as educators struggle to maintain high-quality health benefits at affordable rates. Again, the decision to support this bill represents a major departure for school employees to do things differently as it relates to their health insurance benefits. A few features of Senate Bill 6 we believe are essential to maintain in order to allow employees to continue to have a voice in their benefit package are these specifically. We believe that the composition of the OEB board must give equal voice to employees and employers in the design of those health insurance benefits. Senate Bill 6 does that. Employees and employers must continue to be able to bargain with employers over their compensation and ability to bargain over the who pays aspect of health insurance. Senate Bill 6 also guarantees that. Both these elements are characteristic of the arrangement that exists at PEB and for those employees, and have proved those have proved to be workable for all concerned. With me today, with those introductory remarks, I would like to introduce you to the two people with me today. First, Steve Carlson from Watson Wyatt Company, and OEA's Executive Director, Joanne Waller. So I'll turn it over to Steve.
Mr. Chairman and Committee, my name is Steve Carlson with Watson Wyatt Company, consulting actuary with the OEA. My testimony, the notes for my testimony are the document that was just handed to you. It looks like this. I'll limit my comments to a few comments about the rationale for pursuing a bill such as this, as well as some comments about the potential for savings and the source of those savings. As Tricia said a moment ago, the current cost situation in Oregon is one where you're faced with a bit of a double bind, with healthcare costs increasing very rapidly and tax revenue down. In addition, as has been noted by others in the room, we have a situation where there are dollar caps in place for school district employees. I would ask you to turn your attention to slide 3 as an illustration of where the cost for health benefits for school employees is projected to be by the year 2006. By our estimates, the current costs for school employees in the state of Oregon are approximately $700 million today. And the current rate of increase in those costs, and when I say current, I mean the rate of increase that we've experienced the last couple of years and are projected to experience the next couple of years, is somewhere in the range of 10 to 15%. There have certainly been examples that have been greater than that range. If so, we would expect that the total cost for health benefits for school employees in the state of Oregon would grow to something in excess of $1 billion by the year 2006. According to those projections, really is the rationale for taking some meaningful action in this area. An alternative perspective on the cost situation takes into account the presence of the dollar caps today. On slide four, you'll see a summary of the cost from the perspective of the total premium and how that might be shared in a situation where there is a dollar cap. So in the year 2003, the illustration shows that $700 per month amount for the total premium, and then shows that shared on an annual basis where the school employee would be paying $2,400 a year, and the dollar cap would be $6,000 a year. In that situation, and with the trends expected in the next couple of years, this illustrates that even if the caps were to increase at a rate much less than the rate of healthcare inflation, the burden due to the increase in healthcare costs would grow tremendously for the school employee, and depending on the nature of the collective bargaining, could grow for the district as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So wouldn't it make sense that there would be pressure, to look at wage increases, for instance, if your other personnel expenses go up with regard to health insurance? It would all, the hydraulic would be almost to force the collective bargaining process to be looking at wages to talking $200 a month.
Based on my experience, I believe that's a reasonable conclusion to draw, that if the wage contribution that an individual employee makes for their health benefits is approximately $2,000 today, and it was going to grow to about $6,000 per year 3 years from now, as an individual, if that was happening to my wage base, I would be interested in some discussions about my wage rate.
Thank you.
Turning to slide five, just a brief summary of the opportunities for savings through a statewide pooling of the health insurance. And I've categorized my comments into opportunities for immediate savings and opportunities for savings in the future. Opportunities for immediate savings really come in the area of plan administration, reducing the complexity of that administration, the bureaucracy that was referred to in previous testimony, and to achieve economies and promote efficiencies there. In addition, there are certainly health insurance premiums for our programs throughout the state today that contain an element of agent commissions, and that would be eliminated in a statewide pooling approach such as this. In addition, there would be an opportunity to increase provider discounts with regard to the amount reimbursed under these plans to providers in the community. And there would also be an opportunity to eliminate stop-loss or risk premiums, which are a portion of not all but many premiums in the state today. So these are some of the sources of immediate savings. In the future, in a program such as this, there would be the opportunity to really address what I might characterize as the demand side for medical services. You could also describe it as future opportunities for the promotion of health to reduce the need for certain medical services. That's an area that certainly an area of future opportunity. It's not one that we have made an attempt to estimate any savings around at this point. But it's my understanding that the PEP program will be looking into some of those opportunities with regard to the future in the near future as well.
So just on plan administration, because we kind of went around this, and I didn't have the actual figure, but I guess you and Mr. Dudley, and that was one of his two or three big points, disagree. He says don't create a bureaucracy. You say there's savings that are going to occur because it's going to be, you have a bureaucracy. Do you know about how many individuals or administrators you might be able to save by creating one statewide pool?
I believe that the I believe that the figures are probably greater than the ones that you cited in the last round of testimony. You were estimating that there might be 30 or 40 individuals around the state in the current, if I can call it, fragmented system. I believe that there are probably a greater number than that, could be in the range of 50 to 100.
I was just referring to conversations. As I had gotten involved with the bill, I ended up having conversations with folks from OSCA Trust to OEA Trust to others, and that's where I just started counting up, because I had heard the argument about a bureaucracy, and I wanted to see whether that held water or not. Senator Starr.
Well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, could be, maybe, there might be. Are there? Where are they? Who are they? What are the numbers? This could be fantasy land. There's no real, Mr. Dudley sat there and said zero, except for a handful, two or three people that have parts of their jobs on this, at least at the OSBA side. It's covering approximately half of the teachers or the school employees now. So the chair mentioned 30. You've said 50 to 100. Where are these people? What are they doing? And how are those dollars going to be saved?
I don't have definitive figures on that, but my estimate is based on my understanding of the way purchasing occurs, not only for school districts, by school districts throughout the state, but by many employers throughout the state, and that is that they have some sort of representative, agent, broker, administrative manager, so forth, variety of different individuals who assist with the process of purchasing health insurance. And when smaller groups purchase on that basis, they tend to each have some advisor in that regard. When larger groups pool together, then you don't need all of those advisors cumulatively for the new pool. So I don't have definitive figures, but
Mr. Chair, now are those district employees that you're talking about, school district, actual school district employees that you're talking about that for whatever reason are part of this district and have this area of responsibility as it relates to the employees in that district? Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm really talking about outside advisors, although there may be some school district employees, but I'm not aware. I can't comment on that,
Mr. Chair.
Senator,
if we're gonna walk down this road on creating a new state agency, the issue of how much savings there is in administration, really, we need to get to the bottom of, in my opinion. I mean, we can't somehow, some way, we got to get our hands around that. Not anecdotally, but real numbers, hard numbers about what we're saving. We can't claim that we're saving a certain amount of money here without really knowing where the people are, I guess.
Yeah, I'd like to have, I don't know how feasible, because we do have a fragmented system, but I would like to have an exact figure, or as precise as we could get, of how many folks are involved. I'm pretty confident that you will beat that 17, but I think it's worth having as evidence.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corker.
I think it's a very hard figure to find. I would guess that you would find somebody with some relationship to health care purchasing in every school district administrative office in the state. And I just think of my own experience with doing local government contracts and what a local government, whether it's City of Springfield, Coos Bay North Bend Water Board, Curry County, I've had experience with them. And then watching the PEB system work in terms of state workers, and I got to tell you, Senator Starr, it would be a fine exercise to do this. I think it would be very hard, but I'm convinced that the pooled structure really is a lot more efficient administratively. I mean, they got anywhere from 7 to 14.
I think it's 14 today. They believe 17 will be the 0305. Okay. The new hires are agreed to. We interrupted you, please.
Okay. Really, I'll just wrap up my testimony. The last slide is an estimate that I've prepared with regard to the estimated annual savings of the statewide pooling. And it's really the same illustration that was referred to in prior testimony, illustrating the source of the $65 million savings that could be accomplished through the statewide pooling compared to today's situation.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Questions? Joanne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have some written testimony before you. Basically, all that that testimony says is what process we used, what are some of the things that we looked at the OEA as we decided to support mandatory statewide pooling. I'm not going to go over all of that with you, but there are a few things that I'd like to talk to you about. I think this whole idea of an Oregon Educators Benefit Board is about the future, not about the present or even about the past. It is about the future. When I looked after Mr. Carlson did his work for us and he demonstrated to us that if we stayed on the course we were on, that by 2006, even with 10% increase in health insurance over those years, that school districts or a combination of districts and employees were going to be paying over $1 billion for health insurance, it sobered me up pretty quickly that we needed to stop, take a look at what we were doing, and see if there were some ways that we could save money. $1 billion, if you think of it in terms of the state school fund and the amount of money that the state is putting out for two schools through the state school fund, the highest estimate that the governor's putting in his budget is $5.3 billion. If you think by 2006, $1 billion of that is going to pay for health insurance, it seems to me that if we could save $50 million, $65 million, $75 million dollars in doing that, we ought to take a pretty serious look at it. So we appreciate the opportunity, Senator Deckard, for to look at your bill and to talk about those things that are in it. This is about the future. Employees all over the state of Oregon, school employees, already share costs on health insurance. They share it in one of two ways. Either they're paying out-of-pocket costs for health insurance, or in those situations where they're not, their salaries are lower to reflect the fact that they are not having to pay out-of-pocket health insurance costs. That's simply the way that it is in 2003 in Oregon and all across America. We think that this particular mandatory pooling bill gives us an opportunity to try to control costs. Control costs not just for school districts, but control costs for employees as well. And whenever we do that, then I think earlier someone testified to the fact that pooling won't reduce the amount of money that school districts pay. It'll only reduce the amount of the amount of money that that employees pay, and that isn't true. It simply is not true. Pooling will control the costs of health care. The decisions for health insurance and how those costs will be divided up will still be made under your bill, Senator Deckard, at the bargaining table, which we think is the appropriate place to make those decisions. So we... I'm sorry.
Joanne, you kind of refuted, I guess you did it there, but you refuted the point that Mr. Dudley made, and I thought he made it well, was that really by just staying in the OSBA pool, I guess, to, and I don't see him out there, there you are, to summarize is that if you want to see cost savings, just stick them all into the OSBA pool and we'll get you those cost savings that you're looking for, senators. How would... You touched
well,
on that there.
Yes, there's a big difference between putting all of us into a monopoly where no other school employees would have the opportunity to do anything except pay OSBA for health insurance, then having a board set up where employees and employers together, along with other with insurance experts, can sit down together and decide what it is that that health insurance is going to look like on a statewide basis. Those are entirely two different things. That's why the pool in terms of the Oregon Educators Benefit Board is appealing to us, is that we still will have the opportunity to say these are the kinds of things that are important to employees, and employers will have the opportunity to say this is what is important to us, rather than the Oregon School Boards Association in their trust saying what they believe is right for everyone. We think that's a monopoly. We believe the other is a way for us to come together and make decisions together. If you look at my written testimony, we finally, at the end of all of our study with the OEA's Health Insurance Commission, came up with several recommendations that our organization has adopted about things that we want to do about health insurance. But chief among them is that we pursue the establishment of a mandatory statewide health insurance pool for school employees through OEA's legislative program. We think that is the key. All of the research that we've done, everything that we've looked at as we've talked to other states, says that pooling, mandatory pooling, is the place where you have, that's where you have the best chance for cost savings. And then out of that pooling, you can drive other cost savings, like limiting the number of plan offerings, looking at the actual benefits that are in the offerings. You have an opportunity to come together and make those things happen. So we feel strongly about this bill, and we have very strong support of it. We urge, we hope that this will go forward so that we can deal with the details and make this work for employees and employers and for school districts. And I think we ought not to overlook here, for the state of Oregon, a savings of whether you take $65 million, which is what Steve's estimates are, if you take OSBA's savings of $75 million by pooling, putting everyone into the same pool, or $50 million, I have to be I sat back here when the first presenter today on the federal tax cuts happened to mention that we were going to lose $52 million more dollars in revenue. I think that Senate Bill 6 gives us an opportunity to make up that loss in a way that would be helpful to school districts and to employees.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Corcoran.
Does your organization receive a, what do they call it? I want to say tribute, but I know that's not the word.
Royalty.
It's royalty.
Yes.
Off of your health insurance plan?
You want them mixed up?
No. OEA Choice Trust is an arm of the OEA, but we, the Oregon Education Association, receives no income from the trust, no royalty from the trust.
Thank you.
Well, we do receive some income. That's not exactly true. OEA Choice Trust rents, leases property from us for their offices, and they pay us for that. So we receive that income from them. But other than that, we don't get a commission on any of the sales or any royalty, depending on how many policies are sold in districts.
And, Mr. Chair, just one
follow-up.
To ask a question I don't know the answer to, how many staff do they have?
OEA Choice Trust has approximately, I think it's around 30 staff people.
Okay. Thank you for the questions. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. I have to depart for a 3 o'clock meeting, Senator Farioli. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Adjourned.
I'm going to make sure you're to your meeting on time, Mr. Chairman. Please, if we could have Mr. Shercliffe, Mr. Gray, come forward.
Would you put out the rule about no more actuaries, please?
And is there a Mr. Gray here, Mike Gray?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You can backstop Mr. Shercliffe. And
I'm sorry, Senator, we violated the no actuary.
You just threw right off the top here, violated it. Bring the other guy up. I want to see him duel. I wonder if either one of them knows any actuary jokes. When I did the PERS hearings, not one stinking actuary in the room had a joke to tell.
It's against the bylaws.
Against the bylaws. Thank you.
Good doing this.
Mr. Shercliffe, you want to proceed, please?
Yeah. I'm Dr. Mike Shercliffe. I'm president and CEO of Advantage Dental Plan. I'm what Mr. Dudley would call one of those little companies that's trying to experiment and stick our neck out. We're a licensed dental insurance company in the state of Oregon, and it's interesting to listen to the testimony. I suspect if centralized planning worked, that the Soviet Union would have won the Cold War. And we feel like that entrepreneurialism in the state of Oregon and the United States is something that we ought to be able to do. And part of the problem with health care today is it's very highly regulated, and it's really truthfully becoming a monopoly. And to further concentrate that power into few hands, we wonder if that's wise. And so I've given you a copy. We're so small, I also included an article about who we are. We're actually a community-based health care dental company that's owned by a group of dentists in rural Oregon, organized in a fashion that that would allow us to help our communities, at least with their dental health issues. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 6. I've taken Senate Bill 6, in our opinion, is anti-competitive, effectively eliminates small company like ours from interacting with our local rural communities and working towards dental health benefit package that have proven to save the local school districts and community colleges money. Advantage Dental Plan presently, and I've listed the school districts and ESD and community colleges that we presently insure, and is presently bidding on many other school districts. The comparable plans that Advantage Dental is currently offering are priced in a range of 10% below the larger carriers, which either makes the larger carriers become more price competitive, saving the districts and community colleges money, or allowing Advantage Dental to insure more districts for the same cost savings. School teachers, classified administrators are already organized in large groups through their unions and associations. This legislation further concentrates the power of the teachers, administrators, and classified into fewer people at the top of the unions, and further take one of the few tools out of the hands of local school boards to save monies in their communities. Concentrating power and employee benefits overseen by a board appointed by the governor has a track record that has proven to be inefficient, at times self-serving, and further out of the hands of the people charged with overseeing budget, namely you, the legislature. Concentrating more people into fewer hands has not proven to be cost-effective, considering the teachers' union, school board associations, and classified personnel still are largely dealing with the same two large Oregon companies with very little hope of any competitive bidding. Further concentrating the power into one board effectively leaves smaller companies like Advantage out of the picture by sheer size of the potential contract, whereas on a smaller scale, smaller companies like ours can work with our communities to find local solutions to save money. Community-based health care works and may be the one of few tools we have to allow communities to effectively come together with cost-effective solutions to health care. We, the dentists of Advantage System, urge you to vote no on this very anti-business, anti-competition bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Question, Senator Corcoran.
First of all, I'm curious about this. What is this teachers union that's in your third to last paragraph? Is there a teachers union in the state?
Teachers union? Mm-hmm. There's an educators, Oregon Education Association.
Oh, that's what you mean, but...
Yeah.
Another question, Mr. Chair.
Question follow-up?
Does your outfit pay a royalty to OSBA?
No, we pay commissions to brokers who to help us, the school districts, arrange different benefits.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Final question. Where in the bill are you prohibited from bidding on any future work with this particular board?
Senator Corcoran, Mr. Chair, for a little company like ours to get to the table, when we can sit down with our local school boards and our local teachers and our local communities, and we can talk about health care at that level, and we can then contract it with the assistance of brokers or direct, we can actually work with the community to come up with a package that makes sense. They can look at different medical insurance carriers, all different kinds of benefit packages. But for us as a small company to get to the table, when you're talking about 80,000 people, our company is not large enough to swallow that kind of piece of business, and therefore we're effectively shut out of the bidding process.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little bit at a loss, Dr. There's no possibility under Senate Bill 6 that there could be several. I mean, HEB has several carriers statewide. They don't have all one carrier for health care. So why couldn't you go to the school boards and the teachers union and ask them to go to this board and say that they've had a relationship, ongoing relationship with your business, and have that continue?
I suspect you could, sir, but when you really read the bill carefully, it makes it very difficult for that to happen.
Okay.
In my opinion.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you,
Doctor. Yes, Mr. Gray.
I was called up. I didn't have a.
Thank you.
You were. He doesn't have an opinion.
Signed up and.
Just tell him what he has to say.
It's also against the bylaws. No opinion.
You're excused, Mr. Gray.
That's
thank you very much.
In one day. That's a 15-yard penalty, sir. Pretty soon they'll be calling you an accountant.
Okay. Steve Carlson, Tricia Bozak, and Joanne Waller together. Have they already testified?
Okay. Can we be of any help?
McIntyre and Parks. Did they testify? Janet McIntyre and Trish Parks, please.
Hurry up, go to the Rules Committee. I just want to say that. Let's do that. Anybody else, please?
When you're ready, ladies.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Janet McIntyre, and I'm president of the Salem-Keizer Association of Classified Employees. I represent approximately 1,900 support staff in the Salem-Keizer School District, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 6. I'm here to tell you about the challenge we have faced to provide adequate medical benefits at a reasonable cost to both our employees and the district over the past 5 years. Prior to 1997, our insurance rates had been flat for a number of years. As a result, we felt secure in agreeing with the district to implement the very first insurance cap. We never thought we would reach the top of this cap. However, during the first year of the cap, our rates began to escalate. Faced with increasing costs, we had to decrease the level of services provided in these plans. This erosion has continued. In 1997, we offered a PPO plan that had a $100 deductible, a $3,500 stop loss, and a 90-70 coverage for physicians inside and outside the plan, respectively. Our HMO plan began with a $5 copay. Today, our PPO plan has a $250 deductible, a $3,500 stop loss, and an 80-60 coverage for physicians inside and outside the plan. Our HMO plan has a $10 copay with 80% coverage for hospitalization and an out-of-pocket maximum of $1,500. Our employee contributions have gone from about $10 per month for the PPO coverage in 1998 to over $127 per month today, an increase of over 1,000% in 5 years. Our HMO was fully covered under the insurance cap in 1998, but today it costs employees over $78 per month. These costs are incurred by full-time employees. Our part-time employees who need full benefits packages for their families pay an average of $267 a month, which results in a very limited income. The average salary for our employees is $20,000 a year, and yet our full-time employees must pay between $938 and $1,533 annually for their insurance premiums alone, not including deductibles or copay costs. And all the while, the level of services provided erodes. Our district cap remains one of the lowest in the state at $550 for full-time employees. All employees in the district are subject to this cap, administrators, teachers, and support staff. Even though both our association and the district realize the need to increase this cap, Oregon's financial crisis makes it very difficult. The current situation of rising costs and shrinking services is intolerable. We need your help in creating solutions that allow school district employees to have a fair benefit package and an affordable benefit package. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Sam?
Mr. Chair and committee, I'm Patricia Parks, and I'm an eighth grade teacher in Beaverton, and right now I'm currently serving as the Beaverton Education Association president. I'm here to represent my 2,600 members, and I'm here to speak for Senate Bill 6. I serve on our school district's insurance committee, and we review employees' usage or experience. And our cost increases the last 2 years, last year was 15%, this year was 17.5%. The projected out-of-pocket costs for our employees for our PPO is $220 a month this next year. Beaverton has been very careful with our experience, and we educate our employees about the fact that usage drives up the cost. Our employees have done a great job and used our insurance responsibly, but even so, our insurance costs are skyrocketing. 2 years ago, the Beaverton Education Association bargained a cap because we recognized the reality of where we are in it with insurance, and we recognize that it's partially part responsibility of the employee to pick up the cost. So we bargained a cap. However, the district is unable to keep pace with the increase of insurance costs, and they can't keep pace with the increase of the employee's contribution in our salary schedules. So this has resulted in a loss to the employees. Our insurance cap is currently $522. It's quite low. I recognize the rising cost of insurance is moving into a state of a crisis where no one will be able to afford quality insurance. That's why I'm here today. Some components that would be important to our members would be, of course, choice of carriers, choice of plans, local bargaining for local caps, OEA representation on this education or benefit board. And I must add a few things specifically. Our experience is largely due when we started looking at this board looks at the experience of the employees. And it's largely due to stress-induced ailments and treatments. And the second highest usage is heart disease. So I feel compelled to add some specifics that hopefully that this board, this educator board, will get into later. And something our PE specialists and our younger teachers have suggested, which would they'd be interested in looking at some naturopathic options, as well as giving credits to healthy lifestyles that include exercise. But I need to close with, we have to be able to offer a complete and quality compensation package to attract new teachers into this state, because we're losing them. So I urge you to support this Senate Bill 6.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for the panel? Hearing none? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could I have Richard Schwartz, please? Patty O'Sullivan? Chris Smith? Michael Dembrow? As a panel. You'll wait. Thank you. Welcome. Begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Richard Schwartz, and I'm the executive director of the American Federation of Teachers of Oregon. We represent over 10,000 workers in K through 12, community college and higher education and faculty and classified positions, as well as others in healthcare workers and child care providers. Today I'm testifying on behalf of our classified and other school employees who will be directly affected by this legislation, as well as our faculty and classified members at the community college level who may be as well be affected. AFT Oregon supports the concepts provided in Senate Bill 6, pooling in order to increase the buying power for health care coverage for school employees and keeping costs down for employer districts and our members. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation poll issued in earlier in March of this year discovered that despite terror warnings, a sagging stock market, and the eve of war with Iraq, the public's top concern was rising health care costs. This finding should surprise no one, given that skyrocketing increases in insurance premiums. In 2002, according to a separate Kaiser Foundation poll, 41% of workers were paying an average of 30% more for their coverage and or getting less benefits than just 1 year prior. These enormous increases are being borne more and more frequently by hardworking Oregonians. A decade ago, most school employees in Oregon received full health care coverage. Today, according to Oregon School Boards Association, a sponsor of the plans carried by many of the employer districts, only 12% of the districts are paying the full insurance premiums for employees. The other 88% now cap premium payments or require significant out-of-pocket expenses in order for their employees to receive health care coverage. And let me give you one example of one of our members. She's a bus driver who works for a school district in eastern Oregon who made an annual salary last year of $11,265, or about $939 per month. The employer contribution to her health care was $379 monthly. The required employee contribution was $297 monthly, some 44% of the cost. The employee annual contribution alone is more than 30% of her $11,000 a year pay. That, by the way, is only 78% of a legislator's annual pay. Now factor in rent, food, a proposed budget freeze with no cost of living adjustments, and ask yourselves, could you live on this wage? How would you provide health insurance to yourself and your family? Senate Bill 6 provides at least some hope for controlling costs while extending benefit coverage to all school employees. Finally, beyond schools, we also encourage you to search for solutions this session to provide adequate and affordable health care coverage for all Oregonians. There is a direct correlation between lack of coverage and increased reliance on emergency medicine, which in turn drives up the cost for workers who have health insurance coverage and their premiums to their employers. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have. And I'd like to introduce to you Michael Dembro, who is a faculty member at Portland Community College and president of Local 2277, Portland Community College Faculty Federation, who also has a few comments in support of the bill.
Welcome. Thank you, Senator Ferrioli, and members of the committee. Stick said, I'm Michael Dembro. I teach English at Portland Community College, have done since the early 80s. And when I'm not doing that, I'm president of the Faculty Federation, which represents about 2,000 full and part-time faculty and academic professionals there. I've also been involved in collective bargaining at the college since about 1984 and have seen firsthand the challenges that we face in dealing with this healthcare crisis. And I really applaud the governor's office and the framers of this legislation for joining us in our quest to contain healthcare costs, which is a goal that I think is shared by employees, employers, and the community at large. I'd also like to thank them for including community colleges in the legislation. Sometimes we feel that we're, you know, the forgotten leg in the education stool. And it really is important that this legislation include us so that we have an opportunity to join this group or to opt out. I appreciate the flexibility that the legislation envisions so that the college can opt in or not, depending on what's best for the district. Another real benefit, I would say, is the opportunity to cover part-time faculty under this bill. As you may know, PCC, like many community colleges, relies substantially on part-time faculty to teach our courses. Many of these people are teaching the equivalent of 50% to 75% of a full-time load or more if they teach at several different institutions. And yet they have no access to health care coverage through their employment. For years, we at PCC have tried to get coverage for them through our regular OSBA plans, but because of OSBA limitations, we haven't been able to do that, even at their own expense. These people work their hearts out for the college and for their students, and it's really important. They deserve the opportunity to at least be able to buy into a plan that can insure them and their families. We have a system at PCC where we provide some funding for part-timers who teach at a certain level to be able to buy insurance on their own. It's a small amount, but the problem that they face is they have to go out and buy very, very expensive insurance on an individual basis. This would allow them to be part of a much larger pool and to be able to buy that. And let me say, I just want to stress that the amount that the college would have to pay is, of course, completely subject to bargaining. This would be something that the college and the union would have to come to agreement on. And so I think the overall costs, you know, would certainly match the reality of our funding situation. And just in closing, I just want to say one last thing about the cap. There's been talk about the cap. We at PCC have had a health benefit cap since I've been there in the early 80s. It's a concept that we really believe in. But I just want to stress that, you know, as has been said before, you cannot separate the cost of health insurance from the cost of salaries. You have to look at total compensation. And the extent to which we can keep the costs of health insurance down, the more we can keep the cost of total compensation down. As healthcare costs go up, we need to push for higher salaries in order to help people to pay at least part of that rising cost. Thank you, senators, for your time, and be happy to answer any questions.
Actually, I do have a question.
Yes.
Currently, you're offering an insurance package. Do you put out an RFP? What is the mechanism that you provide health insurance for?
Well, we provide health insurance for our full-time employees through the OSBA. That covers all our full-time employees at the college. Part-timers, we have a pool of money. It's $100,000 a year, which gets divvied up among eligible part-timers to reimburse them for insurance that they have purchased on their own.
So it's private?
It's private, pay. Yes, and it's very expensive.
Okay. And in this proposal, if all of the demand is aggregated and an RFP or a request for proposals is floated, that one purchaser will in fact make the market. In other words, wouldn't this large aggregation of demand essentially make the market for health insurance in Oregon?
I'm not sure I understand.
Okay. If you're a big enough purchaser, you can pretty well get the best deal, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't that the whole point of this thing?
Right, yes.
Okay. So if you get the best deal, what happens? I mean, basically people are going to respond to that request for proposal by writing their best proposal. And so obviously the larger demand that you can aggregate, the lower the cost is going to be for the insurance, right?
Well, I think that's the goal.
Yeah, I think that is too. The question I'm wondering about is what happens to those that respond to the request for proposals and are not successful in that selection? They lose the business, right?
You're talking about the private insurance that, say, these partners.
No, I'm actually talking
about... You're talking about in general.
Yeah, in the general sense, if this benefit is available mm-hmm. and we aggregate the demand statewide, one company or more, maybe a couple companies, are certainly going to benefit because they're going to be able to write the business...
The most competitive.
Bid,
which would save us the most money.
Right, but their competitors will not get that business. And I'm just wondering what the future of competitiveness is if we allow one organization or one entity to make the market for health insurance.
Well, one of the things that we face is, you know, I mean, the OSBA is already a pretty large group.
Yes.
And we're limited to, you know, the packages that they put together.
And they're hard to find, aren't they? The OSBA even has a hard time underwriting and finding underwriters to offer. I believe that's true anyway. We'll call some of those mm-hmm. folks up later. Yeah. Any other questions for the group? Yeah. Thank you for your testimony.
Great.
Patty Owen and Trish Smith, please, I think were the next two that we had available.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Portland Public School District. And I'm here to offer an amendment which is being handed out. This bill currently exempts self-insured employers and school districts with trusts, of which we are one of them. We are self-insured and we have a trust. My understanding, and I'm not an actuary or anybody that's an insurance guru. So my understanding is that there's four districts with trusts statewide. They're PPS, Crook County, Medford, and North Clackamas. And then additionally, two districts are self-insured. I don't know who those are. But we're the sort of the biggest player as far as having a trust. The bill does exempt, again, self-insured and districts with trusts, and the amendment would allow us to remain self-insured or a trust as long as we met the parameters of the premium level within the pooled group. So we would still have the benefit or the option of being in and out. But what our amendment does is not exempt us. It puts us back in the bill. The reason we want to be back in there is we want to be treated like everybody else. There's no reason that we can think of right now that our employees should be treated at any different standard than every other employee of every other school district in this state. Now, having said that, we recently did cap administrative staff and some of the food service workers. We have 5,000 current and retired employees involved in the trust right now, and we have 800 employees that are under an OSBA plan. We have an option of two or four plans, but under OSBA pooled. The trust premiums right now are $795 a month, and the group plan, the OSBA group plan, we average out over the employees in there $600 a month. Had we been able to, within collective bargaining, had we been able to bring the rest of our employees under that grouped insurance, we would have saved $500,000 a month. During negotiations, we were not able to do that. We had other things that that our district was facing, like 24 days cut, and the teachers agreed in negotiations to work 10 of those days free. They're doing that right now. So they are not getting paid for 10 days of school to keep our kids in school a full year. So I want to recognize that during collective bargaining, gives and takes are obviously out there, and right now they have retained their health benefits as a give, and they have given 10 days free. So I don't want to take that away from them. However, the costs are very high at this point, and we would like them to be, not the teachers, because there's all other unions are in there too. We would like to be treated the same as everybody in this pool. With that in mind, and to acknowledge that collective bargaining needs to happen and gives and takes need to happen within that, the date certain where a self-insured or trust must meet the requirements of the pool would be July 1st, 2006. So it's a little bit further out to give time for. And a trust self-insured could decide not to do that anymore and join the pool. They could still do either one that they wanted. So I'm disappointed Senator Corker isn't here to give me a bunch of baloney, but he's not. So
We'll have to make sure Senator's notified to give you a double ration the next time.
Did he? Thank you.
Committee. So the amendment, the question I have about the amendment, Ms. O'Sullivan, was the chair aware that the amendment was going to be presented today?
Yes.
Okay.
I needed to add one thing. The amendment is, this bill I don't think is moving today, but the amendment is not perfect. Right now, it drags community colleges into it, and that was inadvertent by legislative council. It wasn't supposed to. So we may be presenting a follow-up amendment to take them back out. And
I've talked to them about it. You were just thanked by one of the community colleges for being included in
that. Well, they really aren't included. They're voluntarily included. This would automatically, mandatorily include them, and that's their business, not mine. So I didn't mean to do that, and it was inadvertent.
All right. Now, but the effect of the amendment would be, in fact, to add your group into the bill.
It would add all six districts, the four with trusts who are self-insured and the other two self-insured. So, and I have talked to North Clackamas. They haven't gotten back to me whether they agree or not, but I don't represent them. I just want to make sure I wasn't doing something inadvertent to them. So.
Okay. Questions? Senator.
So this, thank you. This would allow your trust to continue.
Correct.
And the only thing is that it would require is that the same benefits that are afforded members of the newly created bureaucracy under the OEBB would apply to your members.
Correct. If they're pooled and they have this premium level out there in the pool, and then it would allow the trust to then say have that as a goal in July 1st, 06. I need to add that during our bargaining, one of the things that came out in the contract was a group from the school district, the PAT, which is our teachers union, the city and the county, and they're all supposed to go off and work on health care benefits, but they're supposed to work on it as a piece of overall compensation and what that looks like for people in our district. So this would then give a goal for at least the health care piece and whatever else the compensation package ended up looking like. You know, I don't know, but it would give a goal for the health care piece. So, yes, the premiums would not exceed what the pooled group could get.
Just a follow-up.
Follow.
Do you have a sense of the amount of compensation for Portland Public Schools teachers as compared to teachers in the surrounding districts or as compared to the average in the state? As compared to teachers where teachers are paid in our neighboring states?
Senator Starr, I do not have that with me. I could certainly get that for you. I mean, there's a lot of numbers that float around, and you always need to make sure you're comparing apples with apples and oranges with oranges when you start quoting those numbers, and I could certainly get that for you, but I don't have it with me.
Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Starr. The pool would continue to exist, but the potential membership could at some point in time opt into this program. Is that what I'm...
Senator Farrelly, that's correct.
Okay, good. Currently, do you have one provider or several providers that you seek insurance coverage through?
Several.
Several, okay. Mm-hmm. I asked a question earlier about if under an aggregated scenario where all the demand of approximately 100,000 people is aggregated, do you envision there'd be one carrier or a wide variety of carriers?
Senator Farrelly, I've not testified on this bill or the details within this bill, so I don't know what this would look like. I know there's a House bill. All I'm saying is whatever comes out of all of this, please treat us the same as every other school district in this state.
All right. Well, I guess what I'm doing is trying to share a concern by asking the questions. That my concern is that we produce an aggregate demand, which should lower the cost of insurance, mm-hmm. and that's the objective here, but at the cost of a whole variety of other providers that are currently in that market. They won't be in that market or providing those anymore because, ostensibly, you'd be focusing that demand in one or two carriers. And I'm wondering if that will narrow the marketplace eventually or eliminate some diversity in the market. If we aggregate the demand and focus it on one or two carriers, do the competing carriers then seek markets outside the state of Oregon? Are they no longer competitive? And does that have the opposite of the intended effect, that is narrowing the marketplace for providers and eventually raising the prices?
Senator Farrelly, I haven't got a clue. I mean, my guess is that happens every time somebody puts an RFP out and puts a bid out and one person wins the bid and everybody else doesn't. I don't know what happens to their companies.
Okay.
I will tell you, though, I've been in public government for over 26 years, 25 of them, or 24 of them with the state, and now two with the school district. Mm-hmm. And I have basically the same plan now as I did with the state. I think I've had Blue Cross Blue Shield probably 23 of those 26 years because I went to Kaiser once, hated it, and went back. Hope that doesn't offend anybody. But and, you know, sometimes I paid for my kids. Sometimes I didn't pay for my kids. So it went. It was all over. But basically, I've always had just about the same coverage in all those years.
Okay.
So whether there was a whole bunch of other people that have fallen by the wayside over the years, I have no clue.
Okay, and I guess what I'm concerned about is that we've seen if you look at transportation or communications or any of the other big industrial sectors, what we've seen is consolidation of carriers. And now, in response to that, we're seeing consolidation of demand to try to, the balance of power tilts back and forth between the provider and the consumer. At some point in time, you get to an end game where you've got all the demand aggregated in one carrier. And at that point, you're not getting a bid. You're just asking for a quote because, there's no competitiveness left.
And again, Senator, I have never in my 26 years had less than three plans available for me to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been, no less than. I've had up to maybe five in the Salem area, offered. And never less than three. There was always an HMO, then the Kaiser thing, and then sort of this copay premium plan that I never could afford until I got rid of all my kids.
Yeah. So what you needed to do is prove you didn't need the insurance, and then you could afford it. Ms. Smith.
Yeah. I saved a lot of money once they left.
Right.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public sector union representing nearly 20,000 classified and certified education professionals throughout the state in K-12, ZSTs, and community colleges. And we are here in support of Senate Bill 6. You've heard a lot of testimony today, and I'll try not to repeat some of the things that you've heard and keep my testimony short and simple. We believe Senate Bill 6 provides you the best opportunity to significantly reduce costs to government that you've seen this session. We've heard a lot of discussion on a lot of issues this session about how important it is to be efficient, as efficient as possible, to cut costs wherever possible, and to provide the greatest service for the least amount of cost. And we think Senate Bill 6, for the purpose of providing health care to education professionals in Oregon, provides you all of those things. You've heard estimates from a variety of people about what the cost savings would be. My testimony estimates the savings between $25 million and $65 million a year. I tried to have the biggest range I could have given the cost-saving rumors I'd heard in the halls. So I took the lowest, and at that time the highest it's gone up since then in terms of savings. If the savings is only $25 million a year, I'd suggest to you that we'll take it. $25 million is a lot of money, as you know, and we think $25 million is worth having in the budgets that we have at this moment. It would be very, very difficult for us to understand why the legislature would turn its back on such savings at this point, when we're not rolling in the dough anymore, especially when my members, many of my members in Eastern Oregon, are now costed out of health care and are falling into the Oregon Health Plan. From a public policy standpoint, from your perspective, I'm sure you don't think that's a good alternative for public sector workers. It's much cheaper to provide health insurance through their employer than it is for you to provide it through the Oregon Health Plan. And we suggest that that's the proper way to provide health insurance for working Oregonians, including school employees.
Are these classified or non-classified employees?
Classified.
And the classified employees have a wage that qualifies them for the Oregon Health Plan?
Yes, they do.
About how many employees are in that situation?
I don't know, Senator.
Could you get me that information?
I'll try. I'm
particularly interested in why teachers' salaries in Eastern Oregon are about 15% lower on average than statewide. I'm almost certain that would be true with classified employees as well.
I will find out for you what the I will try to find out for you what the difference in salaries is between Eastern and Western classified. We don't represent teachers in Eastern Oregon, so I don't have that information.
Just an observation. I mean, I think the trend is there for classified as it is for teachers.
Nevertheless, we do have classified employees in Eastern Oregon particularly who have fallen below the levels where they can afford their out-of-pocket expenses with health care. We hope that you will see the good policy that exists in this bill and give this an opportunity to work to see if our members can get decent health care and our school districts can provide that to our members and we can together work out the costs. We think this is a terrific idea. We hope that you will run with it fairly quickly because I understand y'all are going home here pretty soon. And I'm happy
Don't
to
bet the
it.
Farm, Ms. Smith. Thanks very much.
Just going by what you I'm hearing.
Yeah. Questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Andrea Henderson, Jerry Donnelly. We have two more witnesses signed up subsequent to this panel, and then I'd like to call back our original presenter, James Sager, just for a wrap. Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association, which represents the 17 community colleges in Oregon. I have with me today Jerry Donnelly, who is the Director of Human Resources for Portland Community College and is also the Chair of the Human Resource Directors Committee for Community Colleges this year.
Welcome.
We wanted to talk specifically about Senate Bill 6 and share some of the concerns that we have regarding this legislation. While we are pleased that community colleges do have, as currently drafted, the option to either join or not join as they may choose. We would like to keep that option available for community colleges, and we have other concerns regarding the bill. Specifically, we are concerned about increased cost. With our colleges, we don't have any actuaries that have come in to take a look at this, but did ask our colleges on a college-by-college basis to take a look at the current PEB benefits and compare them to the benefits they currently offer and compare the cost. And for our colleges, the majority of the colleges came back and either said actually, all the colleges either said that there would be either be the same or be an increase in cost for the colleges to switch to something that was like PEP. Not knowing what the benefits would be like under this new package, it's hard to determine, but assuming that it would be substantially similar to PEP, that was their conclusion, so it would be a higher cost. Secondly, we are concerned that the legislation defines eligible employees for the colleges. Currently, each college, either in the collective bargaining agreements or board policy, define eligible employees for health care. And the definitions that are in the bill would expand that definition and basically confer health care coverage to a broader class of employees than what currently hold it, which would have increased costs for our colleges. That's a very great concern for our colleges, given this current budget scenario and the budget cuts they've already incurred. To have an increased cost would mean essentially that they'd be able to offer less services to their students. With that, I will turn it over to Jerry Donnelly to talk specifically at how PCC looks at this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Excuse me. For the record, my name is Jerry Donnelly. I'm the Director of Human Resources at Portland Community College. I'm here to testify at the request of OCCA, and I need to state for the record that I'm not taking an official position for the PCC Board of Directors. They've not taken a position on this bill. But there are some issues that where the practical impact of the bill, whether the colleges are in or out, still has an impact on us. Mm. And those are the things that I'd like to address. There are sort of two significant ways in which we see that the colleges may be impacted. One of those is the viability of the OSBA trust. Currently, 12 of the 17 community colleges participate in the trust as a primary means of providing insurance benefits for their staff. If all of the K through 12 system is pulled out of OSBA's trust and vested elsewhere, it's going to leave a relatively small group by comparison and is going to put us in a position of having to either bid for insurance individually, as you have been questioning other speakers about, or we're going to have to find a way to pool ourselves as only the community colleges, which again will be a relatively small pool, or we will be forced to move into this plan and the viability of opting out sort of goes away. The second concern that we would have is the impact on bargaining climate. And Mr. Dembro, who was one of the previous speakers, he and I, in fact, have a meeting scheduled tomorrow to begin negotiation setup discussions for our next round of negotiations with the faculty. The issue about inclusion of part-time faculty, as he said, in our benefits programs has been one that we have bargained over for the entire time that I've been at the college, and I presume before that as well. The bill would, in my opinion, would set a certain expectation about a level of coverage. And what I have tried to look at is, if that were the expectation and if we were to go there, using the same kind of systems that we currently have with other employee groups, what would that mean to us? So to give you just a little bit of background, Mr. Dembro mentioned that we are in the OSBA plan and we offer Blue Cross through them. We do also offer employees a Kaiser HMO option outside of the OSBA panel, and roughly half of, about 40% of our employees are on that Kaiser plan. The difficulty that we have with the model that the PEB parallel sets up is the inclusion of employees who work half-time or more. And there is no definition of what that means. And with the volume of part-time faculty that community colleges employ, and PCC being the largest, we have the largest number of those, but it is true of all of the community colleges that we are very heavily dependent on part-time faculty. To expand our roles to include that, or to have the statute set that as the threshold of who ought to be provided insurance coverage at some cost to the employer, is going to make our bargaining, it's going to set a different threshold for us in bargaining. As Mr. Dembro referred to, we have set up a trust fund. It's not an insurance trust per se, where we do RFPs and broker policies, but we have done that as sort of an attempt to be creative about a way to provide some level of coverage to our part-time faculty. The current structure that we have in place, we have caps in place. Our caps are currently either $400 or $420 per month, depending on which bargaining unit we're talking about. The for part-time classified staff, we do a proration, and also for part-time administrators, we have just a couple of those. We do a proration off of that cap. If we were to have to prorate our contribution to include part-time faculty who work at a level of half-time or more, and I will admit that since this isn't defined in the statute about how you would determine who's half-time in a part-time faculty role, I did rough projections based on our current numbers of part-timers as of this term, and the cost to PCC in additional new dollars for that coverage would be roughly $1 million a year. It would be a substantial increase in cost to PCC. And I would assume that from the information that Andrea Henderson referred to earlier that we gleaned from the other community colleges in kind of a quick survey, that's the major driver that is different in community colleges, where this bill would expand sort of the definition. And even if we're opting out and bargaining it, it sets an expectation about who is going to be entitled to coverage. Those are the major concerns. There are a couple of other things. One minor point relative to bargaining that sort of came up indirectly in one of the earlier questions. The bill also includes language that would add in long-term care insurance. In Section 9, Paragraph 3, it makes a reference to that being bargained. We currently offer that plan to employees, a plan, on a self-pay basis. This implies that it would be a mandatory subject of bargaining, so it would expand the scope of bargaining on insurance issues that are already on the table. As a number of people have noted, most of the community colleges and other educational institutions do have caps in place. The pressure on those caps is significant because of the increases in healthcare costs, and we expect that that the expansion of who would be eligible for coverage under this bill is going to create a new tension for us in how we deal with what that cap can be, as well as who all would need to be covered. That concludes my remarks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions members of the committee may have.
Questions? I appreciate the testimony, and thank you very much. I think the issue of how part-time people are defined certainly does affect the community colleges, and I thank you for bringing that issue to the panel. If I could call forward a couple of other folks, Lynn Lundquist, Chuck Bennett, and Cindy Robert are the last three witnesses. Welcome, Mr. Bennett. Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I'm representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to express COSA's concern with Senate Bill 6 and the changes it proposes for school district health insurance plans. First, though, I want to say that COSA supports any plan that definitively saves school districts valuable education dollars by limiting the dramatic escalating costs of health care. And to the extent that supporters of Senate Bill 6 have that policy direction in mind, we thank them for raising this issue. But, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at the time, and I'm thinking in about 2.5 hours I'll be sitting at home over dinner, and I'll start getting phone calls telling me if I'll just change my carriers, I'll save a lot of money. And I'll go through till about 7 o'clock when they quit phoning me from Atlanta telling me that. And I had that feeling here today, that it's that simple, that if you'll just change carriers, just change the way you pool this, there's a lot of money to be saved. The problem, Mr. Chairman, is quite frankly, we can't hear the data yet from either side that indicates this savings is going to occur. And it has this feeling of folks debating with clearly very, very bright actuaries on either side. But again, I want to underscore, if you're going to put us through something like the dramatic changes that would result in Senate Bill 6, we hope that you will have guaranteed, definitive, agreed-upon data that lets us know the savings that are promised will occur and that the savings are substantial enough to put us through that kind of dislocation. I think you've heard all the reasons, certainly better than I can present them, regarding the bill. We certainly agree that exempting the state's largest school district makes no sense. We are not. We've tried to understand how, and I think it is an intuitive argument that larger pools save money, but we're not convinced the data supports that. Again, I don't want to, but none of us want to rely on an intuitive understanding of insurance, because it seems like every time you intuitively understand insurance, something happens and it goes sideways on you. We'd want to know that this larger pool results in competition when firms are asked to write for the pool, that in fact the savings will occur, and in fact there will be bidders to go in on this larger pool. I guess, Mr. Chairman, what we're asking you to do, the school administrators, is that you at least undergo a full threshold review and data collection as well as comparison to make sure that this is going to work, that we just don't need another large state-run bureaucracy to fail at this level, and we think that there is a potential here. We don't know that it will, but what we don't know either is that it'll save us any money, and we're just real worried about it. It's real worried about this coming so late in the session and being such a sweeping change.
Questions?
Mr. Bennett, I think the idea that there is an intuitive savings here is very seductive, and it is intuitively a conclusion that if you aggregate the demand, you'll get a better rate and therefore make savings. But you've asked for I should be calling you the man of La Mancha. You've asked for three conditions, guaranteed, definitive, and agreed upon, and that seems to be, in this building at least, an impossible dream on any topic. But I guess I have the same question for you. Long term, if an RFP is put out covering 100,000 people, more or less, including somehow the largest district in the state, certainly there's going to be one very happy group of underwriters that get that bid. The others will not be so happy, since they will not be writing the business on 100,000 potential insured. And they'll have to change their business strategy, and many of those things may not, in fact, be viable past a couple of insurance cycles. That seems to me to narrow the pool of potential carriers in Oregon significantly. And what you end up with, I'm wondering, is possibly a very narrow pool of carriers competing for one mega account in the state of Oregon. Do you have any thoughts about that? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have trouble when they call me at 6:30 in the evening trying to decide what to do with my car insurance, so I'm not going to hold myself forth as an expert, but when you take a look at the plans offered, there aren't a lot of folks writing this business in the state of Oregon. There isn't a lot of it going on in these larger pools. The other question I've got, and maybe I misunderstand how insurance works, and God knows that would be very possible, but when you start talking about pools of 100,000, you're talking about exposure levels that are so high that I'm not clear that you find the underwriter for that large a pool, and I think that would be at least one of the guarantees we'd want to have, is that there is at least one underwriter out there that'll write that big a piece of business. You know, and the limitation in terms of its impact on the general business of insurance, who knows? They seem to be there. I have no idea whether that will limit or not limit the number of health insurers. I mean, I hear what you're saying, and, you know, I hope that ultimately this is not decided on your intuition or mine, because I don't know that either of us are absolutely correct that larger is better in this case. It seems to make sense. I mean, every time you stop and think about it, it seems to make sense. But I don't believe it is absolutely clear that it, in fact, works that way. And that's my concern.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm here representing one of those businesses that you say would have to change its strategy if this was to come about. I represent Pacific Source. It's a nonprofit health insurance based out of Eugene. We have 7,900 physicians, 200 employees. We cover 127,000 members, and we were started in 1933 by a group of physicians. So we are a small group. What compelled me to want to speak to you today is, first of all, you haven't heard from any insurers. I think that probably in the back of your minds you think your larger ones are probably sitting and thinking about if this would work for them or not work for them. And as a smaller Oregon-based insurance company, I can tell you it wouldn't work for us. I also want to say that you have been told by someone who testified previous to me that the three goals of this legislative session were to cut costs, create efficiencies, and provide greater service. I don't think that the proponents of this bill have shown that it will definitely cut costs. I think if you can't show how many administrators there are, you can't show how much administrative costs would be cut. I think there's a lot of questions there. As to creating efficiencies, this bill creates monopolies. As to creating greater service, not possible. At Pacific Source, in our last month of numbers that we have, I can tell you that our enrollment was 125,634. Our claims turnaround time was 15 days. Our accuracy was 99.7%. Our answer speed for customer service was 26 seconds. Live person, 26 seconds. Our abandonment rate on those calls was 2.2% error. That's all. And our customer satisfaction numbers were 93.58%. I have here a list of 46 school groups that the Pacific Source Health Plan currently writes business for. There are 15 in this column here, what says plans, are 15 different plans named. Not one, not two, not three that they can choose from and call that choice. There are 15 different plans. As a matter of fact, I noticed that on the Crook Deschutes plan column, it says personal option South Central B. And then when you go to Harney, it says personal options East B. So these are tailored to districts within Oregon. What works better for them? What works better for the kind of physicians? What kind of works better for the kind of nurse practitioners they have? What works better for those people? You don't get this when you have a large plan. I hear some people saying, well, how can only one group underwrite this whole plan? We're not sure if they can. I'm not sure that the bill says only one group can do it, but I'm sure it's not very manageable for this new bureaucracy if more than three or four do it. And I will tell you that PacifiCare wouldn't be one of those. Someone had asked earlier, I think it was one of the senators who weren't here, well, why don't you just bid on this? I'm not sure if Pacific Source would bid on it. Could we handle it numbers-wise? Probably not. But even if we could put our arms around it and take care of this business-wise, we wouldn't want to. We've shown that we have a business that offers choices. We tailor to our communities. We do work in our communities. We understand what the people want. And I think the listing of plans that I have here proves that we care about the consumer as more than just a teacher. We can care about them as a teacher, where they live, what their society's like, what kind of services are offered to them. So I'm not sure we'd want to participate in something that is this black and white.
Questions for Ms. Robert? Thank you. We be submitting the list of districts and plans?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, as soon as I get it a size that I can read without magnifying glass, I will give it to you.
I can read them from here, but if you put them on the desk, I can't read.
Superman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America. And actually, Cindy and I were talking back there, and I said that I would come up and actually share a couple of observations. HIAA is an association of predominantly all non-domestic carriers. They do very little public sector business. But I've been around insurance issues probably far too long in Oregon. And part of the reason I came up was because I actually used to be the administrator for the League of Oregon Cities program, and so I bring sort of a different perspective to the discussion. And what I would suggest is that you need to examine the assumptions carefully, because the idea is, for example, when you take a look at OSBA, they are already of the size that they've achieved significant efficiencies. And the assumption is, going into this, is when you expand the pool, your average costs are going to go down. That is not necessarily a correct assumption. Your average costs are going to be driven primarily, in any event, of how any program is structured, by the claims costs that are incurred. Your administrative costs and the rest of those are really secondary. What drives your benefit costs, of course, are what your plan designs are. And when you look at the bill, there are provisions in the bill that actually limit the board's ability, regardless of how good the board is, limit their ability to manage program costs. So there are provisions in there, for example, that individual participants can move among networks almost at will, depending upon their perception of the adequacy of the network. And that's kind of a techie sort of observation. But there are issues in there that we refer to in the insurance arena as adverse kind of selection issues. There is statutory language in the bill that create those kinds of circumstances. And so that gets back into some of the other discussions you've heard, is whether or not you're going to focus on benefit designs and give whatever this program would be the ability to manage that, or are these people primarily going to be looking at negotiating caps and not being able to take a look at the kind of tools you need in order to control the costs that underlie what the claims are that are generated in the program. And I'll just leave it at that. But as I say, it's very important that not only you look at the assumptions that you've heard discussed at length today, but you also need to look at the limitations that are given to the board in terms of what they can do or what they must do in terms of benefit design, as well as what they cannot do in terms of managing the program. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I see that Mr. Lundquist left. So go ahead and call Mr. Sager back, please.
Mr. Sager, this is obviously a huge issue with potential great implications for the districts and taxpayers, and potentially with some great savings offerings. But I think the questions that I heard here, how have you determined what the point of diminishing returns is where size and efficiency curves cross and you don't get any more efficiency for greater size?
Not being an expert on how to calculate the actuarial tables, et cetera, I don't know what the exact numbers are. I do know that there are thresholds at which you cross over. Is it 30,000, 40,000, 50,000? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
What we can recognize is that there are numerous school districts out there who are facing costs that otherwise they may not have to face if Senate Bill 6 were in place and they could participate in this collective pool, and if the districts and the employees could benefit from the cost of having this large pool, as the state employees have benefited from being a part of a state employee pool. So we wanted to look at this because we think this is a way that we can, again, help control costs to school districts, freeing up dollars for classrooms, and provide a decent insurance benefit plan for all employees, and do it in a manner that, as PEB has laid out, that it can be done to emulate that program.
Well, and that, I think, has a qualifier. That's if the assumptions are correct, if the assumptions of aggregation and the assumptions of the availability of carriers are correct, then those things might be true. But I guess people are asking questions about whether the assumptions can be tested, and what are the methodologies. And I don't know, and I don't expect you to be answering these questions for this committee now.
Right.
But I just want to put these questions on the record so at some point in time before this bill gets moved, we get these answers. So I think some people are going to want that. Are we pretty certain that there are competitors out there that would want to write this size of a book of business?
Well, again, PEB has just completed their cycle of looking at their plan. They came in with a 9% increase in what they negotiated with their underwriters. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a problem finding people to bid on their group. We have a lot of history with providers in this state writing programs for education employees. I don't think we're going to run into problems where suddenly we don't have any providers. That, in fact, there are people out there that would like to step up and take on this underwriting responsibility. Also, the bill does not dictate that it is a single underwriter.
Right. So I guess, Mr. Sager, I'm trying to figure out, can we be less tentative about the methodology? If we're talking about aggregation of demand, then that implies that we would have an underwriter. If there's going to be more than one underwriter, then you're really taking that aggregated demand and dividing it among carriers. So I guess what I'm really interested in is finding out, have you figured out just exactly how this configuration is going to go together, and that there are underwriters that want to write that book of business? I mean, I know that there's competitiveness in the industry now because there isn't a market maker. There isn't a dominant purchaser. There's several that have different programs, and they all go out for competitive bid. If we aggregate all the demand in the whole sector that we're looking at and essentially offer it to one or two carriers, that's going to change the marketplace. And I guess I need to know, as nearly as is possible and as reasonable and responsible, how that market distortion will play out in the next several years. Because we are talking about making a fundamental change in the size of the pool that we're going to be covering and possibly offering it back to at least one and possibly a few carriers that currently compete for a variety of business. So I guess I'm really interested in finding out what this methodology will be.
Sure. No, I understand your question, Senator. Thank you. I guess I would have to ask myself, I mean, as I'm sitting here thinking about your question, would we conclude that having our state employees in one pool, has that had a negative impact on the option of insurance carriers, and thus to the detriment of the state? We have to weigh again, kind of the use, the stewardship of tax dollars, and you know what the exchange is, especially when it impacts your implication is that it would impact the economy by driving out other businesses. So I recognize that, and I think that what we have to do is make sure that we show you as best as we can that the balance tips in favor of the state, the taxpayers, and the students for Oregon.
Yeah, I mean, that is perfectly put. What I'm looking for, I mean, obviously 100,000 potential insured measured against a population of 3.1 million, you know, puts a different perspective on it. Mm-hmm. But essentially taking the population of PEV, and I gather it's about the same number of people, and doubling that kind of potential pool, you know, you're still putting out a lot of business in the market in a short period of time. And some carriers are going to be displaced. That was clear from the testimony here today. You know, I'm curious about what happens to the displaced carriers. And I'm curious to know what happens if we, in fact, find a couple of carriers and downstream that 2, 3, 4, 5 years, are we going to see those that saving curve look real good at the front end and essentially zero out as we hit, you know, diminishing returns and lack of efficiencies? That size intuitively tells you you're going to have permanently, but you might not. So I guess I need to hear more about how those things have been thought through.
Well, Senator Farrelly, I'll be happy to come back with some additional thoughts and hopefully some additional information for you. But again, just sitting here thinking about it as you're putting forth this idea, it seems to me that we have certain carriers now that if they want to go in and bid someone out of business, which isn't kind of what you're implying that would happen by this process, that in fact that would be occurring now. That we have some rather large carriers that if the goal was to, you know, monopolize the industry, that would be a strategy that they would have in place. That hasn't occurred. I don't think that we have had a reduction in providers because of pooling of state employees. And if the trade-off for pooling school district employees is that we're able to bring the inflationary costs under at least some control, and we can look at putting more dollars into the classroom to benefit our students, then that, at least from my perspective, becomes the driving force. Okay. And that is what motivates us here today.
Mr. Sager, I want you at least to try to understand my perspective. I watched the rapid rise of HMOs in Eastern Oregon. I watched the overexpansion by population groups in Eastern Oregon, the inability to cost control, and then the collapse of HMOs in Eastern Oregon and Northeastern Oregon and in Central Oregon. So, you know, they went through a very rapid curve of development and outreach and expansion, quickly hit their diminishing returns, and had so many people in the process as they couldn't control cost, and they collapsed. And so I'm real curious not to see the same kind of a rapid growth curve and entry into a market that looks like a great idea, because certainly HMO carriage in Central Oregon and Eastern Oregon and Northeast Oregon looked great.
Right.
It isn't out there anymore. You know, there are just real problems in finding carriers that will offer that anymore. And I think you know the curve I'm referring to. It's a very recent memory. So I'm just curious to see that this methodology has been well thought through so that we don't see the same kind of a curve happen in moving into this market with 100,000 people.
Senator Farrelly, I agree. Thank you.
Senator, did you have any further questions? Is there any other person here present that wishes to give testimony on this bill today? Hearing and seeing none, we are adjourned. Thank you for your testimony.